evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to our council meeting tonight, April 14th, 2014. We appreciate everyone being with us. And as we go through our agenda, if you want to speak on any of the agenda items, you certainly may do so. Just raise your hand, let us know you want to speak, and come on up over here and give us your name. That's all you have to do. We'll begin our meeting with the council prayer and then Pledge of Allegiance to our flag.
Let's bow our heads. Merciful and mindful God, as we work together to build a better Aiken, show us your path toward positive, productive opportunities. Guide us to work together to do what is your will, your way, your life. Teach us patience and persistence. Show us what is right to do together as Aiken. Amen.
Amen.
First item of business of the minutes, consideration of the minutes from the work session and regular meeting of the March 24, 2014, and the budget workshop of April 1st, 2014.
Mr. Mayor, I'd like to make a motion, kind of make it under duress. We've got so many things floating around with all the debris costs and everything. And I have a copy of this to give to the city attorney. And Mr. I make a motion to accept the minutes from March 24th work session, the March 24th city council meeting, and the April 1st budget review work session. The debris work session minutes, which is page 56 to 82, the approval will be continued until we get information from the Aiken Standard FOIA to the city manager and the Aiken Standard FOIA to the SCDOT. I think that's important that we roll all this together. Also, I'm requesting for the city attorney get an FOIA for the documents and emails in relation to how the city and the FEMA and the county and SCDOT have interacted. There's so much information floating around. I think it would be good to collect all this in the minutes, because one of these days, a year or two from now, everybody's going to be asking the questions, what did you do? And there's a lot of emails that go between people that I think is important.
Okay.
So that's my motion.
Okay, do we have a second?
I'll second.
We have a second, okay. Any discussion? All right, your hands please, all in favor. Passes unanimously.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Yeah, you're welcome, sir. Thank you. For the presentations, we have three tonight. River, Savannah River remediation projects update.
I'd be happy to, Mayor. One thing, Mr. Ebner, on what you passed out to council, I've just seen this for the first time. You wanted to accept the minutes, right? ACCEPT? Accept them, not accept.
Accept, yeah.
Okay, I want to make sure you weren't taking exception to the minutes.
No,
you're holding it open for
it
the additional
be an,
information.
ACC instead of EX.
Okay.
Excuse me, you're correct.
Right.
Please change that.
Mayor, we're very honored to have with us tonight Ken Reuter with Savannah River Remediation. The council has a benefit of his presence here tonight. Ken, we've got an opportunity for you to speak here. The chamber organized a tour.
Just walk back there, Ken.
Yes, sir. Yep. Organized a tour of the site. We were able to view some of the projects that SRR is working on. And I've had an opportunity to speak with Ken three or four different times, and he's very interested in coming tonight and sharing with council what SRR is working on currently.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this evening. I thought I'd go ahead and try to something a little different, a little more from a personal perspective, so that we weren't going through PowerPoints and more to address. So let me first, I had two objectives I wanted to accomplish tonight. One was to introduce myself, and then second, to give you sort of a state of the project from when I took over the job in the mid-September 2013 time frame, predominantly to bring you up to date with the what I call the adversity period that we had has recently gone through over the last 6 months relative to government appropriations, lapses, shutdowns, weather events, and things like that. I'm sure that as all your constituents are too, they're very interested in the state of the liquid waste program at Savannah Riverside. So first, just introduce myself. I'm actually have been a long-term resident of Aiken. Actually met my wife here back in the 80s. All our children were born here. And then in the early 2000 time frame, we went off on a journey across the United States as part of URS Corporation, going to all the different DOE sites as part of a series of the cleanup mission that the Department of Energy has. I've been now what I call the tour of the rivers. So I've been to the Columbia River, the Snake River, the Clinch River, the Tennessee River, and now I'm back to the Savannah River for another try at it. I was originally part of the Defense Waste Processing Facility construction team and then operations team for that facility. That's one of the facilities we have, I'm sure you're familiar with, on site that that treats the radioactive waste. Actually, my wife is from Aiken. She's a graduate of Aiken High, so she's obviously very excited to be coming back to this area and living here. So we lived a number of, well, 13 years of our life here before we went on that journey. So what I wanted to share with you today, just to kind of to recap, Savannah River Remediation is a partnership of a number of different companies. The principal partner is URS Corporation. Of course, you know our presence right here on Newberry Street, and we are part of the former legacy company that was called WSRC, or Westinghouse Savannah River Company. Contract was recompeted in the 2007-2008 time frame. We won that. And our principal mission, as you see in the first slide there, is essentially the treatment of the radioactive waste that's the outcome of the National Defense Initiative, commonly referred to as the Cold War Initiative. And you can see that there's a significant volume of waste there that needs to be treated. It's stored in two types of tanks, underground tanks. One of them is considered a old-style tank, and the other is considered a new-style tank. The difference is one of them has a containment around it, that being the new style, and one of them does not, that being the old style. And so our mission is to treat this radioactive waste and put it in a stable waste form through one of two methods, either turning it into glass or turning it into concrete or grout, and then to ultimately close those tanks. And the order of closure is in the order of the most or greatest environmental risk. So the tanks that are the old style tanks that provide the least barrier protection of the environment are closed first, and then the newer style tanks will be closed later. You can see there's a fairly significant volume of waste there, approximately 37 million gallons. What I'd like to point out is in reality, the way the waste is broken up, about 2.7 million of it is sludge. Think of it looking like peanut butter. And the rest of it looks like dried salt. So think of it like a table salt, if you will, that has gotten wet and just kind of glumped together. We have to re-wet that or liquefy it or dissolve it. So that salt, that 34.6 million gallons, becomes 100 million gallons of liquid to be treated. This waste will be treated through three different facilities. You've probably seen them in the news before, or you're aware of them from previous briefings. One is called the Defense Waste Processing Facility. That's the one that vitrifies or turns the sludge and then subsequently the salt into glass. There's the Saltstone Facility, which then takes the low-level waste and turns it into concrete and pours it in vaults on site. And then there'll be a facility called the Salt Waste Processing Facility, which you've probably heard about because it's being built at the site right now, and it will treat the salt waste. So it'll treat that 100 million gallons of material, that liquefied salt or that dissolved salt. And so our third mission, the reason I bring up the salt waste processing facility, is to prepare the liquid waste system or infrastructure to accept that facility when it's finished with its construction in the approximate 2016-18 time frame into the overall liquid waste system so that it can treat the salt. So we're going through a series of projects that connect in the salt waste processing facility, the ability to feed it at a pretty high rate, in excess of 20 gallons a minute, and then take its product and turn it into glass or turn it into concrete, depending on the type of waste it is. And you can see some examples of pictures there. You can see some tanks before they were complete in their construction and then put back with backfill and earth around them. You can see the salt, which you can see just looks like standard salt if you were to have it in your salt shaker and it had gotten wet. And then you see the sludge there, which is that peanut butter and or ketchup consistent kind of material. Wanted to provide you an update of where we're at with regard to overall production for this year. You probably are aware, you know, we received some troubling news in the summer of 2013 with regard to what we believe was going to be our funding level in 2014. It required some reductions in force, and it also required us to turn back a significant amount of the mission other than maintaining the safe storage of the waste in the tanks. We've set off on a collaborative effort. You were part of that. The state delegation was part of that. The governor's office was part of that through the governor's nuclear advisory council and through the Department of Health and Environment, and through all that, working with our delegates, I'm happy to tell you that our funding level has been fully reestablished for 2014. So we now have the facilities up and running. We have our tank closure mission, which you see in the third poster, reestablished. If you were aware, we were supposed to be working on the closure of the seventh and eighth tank in the series of tanks to be closed in 2014. We're now back into those. They're referred to as tanks 16 and 12. They have respective numbers. And they're the next in the importance of tanks. Actually, tank 16 was one of the leakiest tanks on the site, so it's a huge environmental benefit to get it closed. All the waste has been retrieved out of it. And in the production facilities, you see the three main charts there. One is the pilot facility that's treating salt as we speak today. It's referred to as ARPMCU. You see the grout facility or the saltstone facility in the middle, and then you see the defense waste processing facility at the bottom, which is for treating the glass. So all those plants went through a major outage activity in the first quarter of the year as we worked out the funding. We took advantage of that window, completed a number of modifications for life cycle extension. We've restarted those. We obviously were challenged by the weather during the course of that, as you would imagine, and short of having to fend off locusts, we fought every other challenge. We had a seismic event. We had freezing conditions that hadn't been seen in 20 years. We had snow conditions in that we hadn't seen in 50 years. But I'm happy to tell you all these facilities are up and running and on their targets for treating waste this year. And then, as I pointed out to you, the tank closure is back in full action as we speak. And so we are now back into the series of tanks, both the ones that are being closed and the ones that we're retrieving waste from, to ultimately be treated and then equally be closed. And so we have a series of tanks that have to be closed in a schedule that are consistent with the federal commitments called the Federal Facility Agreement, and we're working in that. The last piece I wanted to share with you, because in the execution of our business, think of a triangle, and at each apex of that triangle is a critical part of executing our work, and that's people, programs, and the plants. And so I've talked with you about the programs and the plant piece. The most important part of doing our work, we're a company of people. We're a project of people. We don't produce a product that's sold or retailed or anything like that. And so at the end of the day, what we deliver is the ability of these people to work as an integrated team and deliver these production targets, close these tanks, and perform it in a safe manner. And the safety is the foremost aspect of our work, because without it, it's the foundation for doing our work. So for example, our construction team, which does very, very high hazard work, as you can imagine, you can see the work environment, has worked 26 million safe hours without a lost workday case. Actually, we think that's a national record. And then our operations team, which works, you can see some of them working in that environment right there in that slide, have worked 4.3 million safe hours without a lost workday. And the key of that's four OSHA President's Awards. And actually, this is the safest high-level waste treatment site in the nation to work, if probably not in the world. And so obviously our people are very proud of that aspect of it, and it's foundational. And what we have both seen objectively and by observation, and Richard and I have talked about it a few times, is that there is a direct correlation between employee fitness for duty, safety, and wellness. Matter of fact, just in the last year, we've seen that in a majority of our strain-based injuries have been associated to people that had wellness challenges. And so we've instituted a program called The Biggest Winner, in which we've allowed our employees to form teams. We've offered them a free wellness screening through the University Hospital, and through that, you can see the parameters that they look at. It's much more than weight loss. It's really focused on wellness. So it's cardiovascular, it's blood-based, it's lifestyle. And so they took a baseline in January. They'll be offered an opportunity for a final screening in June. And then the teams with the best reduction will be the biggest winners. And from that, URS is providing them mountain bikes and a free guided mountain biking ride here by me, actually. And so we have employees training at Hitchcock Woods, at Boyd Pond Park. Here we have people running in the United Way 5K, 10K that's coming up here in the city, I guess, at the end of April, right, and things of that nature. And in my meetings with both city officials and county officials, we've talked a lot about wellness, because I know that you all have had a focus on the importance of wellness overall. This has been very exciting for our people. So I just wanted to kind of share that with you. If you come across some people training, it may be one of these 200 that are participating on this team. So unless you had any questions for me, I'd didn't want to take a lot of time. I know you have a very busy agenda here, and I'm at your disposal, so you're welcome to. I'll come back whenever you'd like me to.
Ken, you said funding is good for 2014. Mm-hmm. What does it look like for 2015?
We're fairly optimistic for 15. I think the reason for that optimism isn't just blind hope. The fiscal year previous to an upcoming fiscal year sets the basis for it. There's no guarantees in that, but. If you go in low and there's another continuing resolution, you would stay low. So that above and beyond reestablishing 14 to be able to get back on mission pace, it sets the basis if we were to go into another continuing resolution for 15. So being back up on target for 14 is a good foundation for 15. And then secondly, although the appropriational process is not done, and it won't be done until much deeper into the calendar year, the president's budget is very positive for Savannah River Remediation and the liquid waste program. It's up significantly from last year's numbers, and so we think with that number, along with how efficient we're running the job, just for a point of reference, we ran the job about $14 million efficient in the first half of this year, and obviously we reinvest that money into the mission. We call it growth and mission delivery. That those savings we'll see the remainder of this year, plus the president's budget sets us up for a very good 15.
Mm-hmm. What can we do to help?
Same thing you did for us over the course as we exited the summer last year. I mean, the common voice from the city elected officials, from the state elected officials, from the initiatives that the governor's office and the commissioner laid out, along with our federal delegates, we had one common message there, and it was about the delivery of this mission and understanding how it related to environmental management and how it related to reducing the risk. This is a multi-generational mission, and I think we may have lost, we did not lose sight of that. I think maybe as a nation we had lost sight of that in decision and priority making, and we brought that to the forefront again with a common voice, and it made a huge difference in my opinion. So I actually, we appreciate, I mean, all 1,700 people appreciate your representation on that.
Ken, how many tanks are still there with liquid in them?
In the 40s.
In the 40s?
Yeah, we've closed six.
Okay.
There's 24 of these old style tanks, so at the end of 2015, we'll be one-eighth or one-third of the way through those. Mm-hmm. Those pose the most environmental risk. The new style tanks, especially the construction of these, I think we're in pretty solid shape. So then it becomes just focusing on the treatment mission. They will ultimately be closed, but they'll be on the second half of the closure cycle.
Assuming you get the finances that you need, how long would it take to finish all the tanks?
It's around the 2025-2028 time frame. Like I said, that's why I said it's multi-generational.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Our objective is by 2018-19 to be treating about 9 million gallons a year of the salt waste. So I mean the math works out to be fairly simple. There's not much sludge left to treat. It's about halfway done.
Very good.
That has huge environmental benefit to this
sure.
to our area because you know most of the most long lived or most dangerous radionuclides are in that sludge.
You mentioned tank 16 being somewhat of a leaker. I guess it's not to the point where it's real bad. Or
no, well, it's empty. We've emptied it.
It's empty now.
It's emptied. It's ready for closure.
Yeah, good.
If you get a chance later on, you can look through the posters. You can see the different stages of closure.
Mm-hmm.
And bulk waste retrieval, waste removal is one of the early stages.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Any other comment?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time and being here to update us.
Ken, thank you so much.
Ken, I might add that we have asked, if you don't mind my saying, Mr. Mayor, SRNS, and Ken's not listening. Ken, I was sharing that we have also asked Savannah River Nuclear Solutions, in addition to Dave Moody, to come and make presentations as well to update us, and you're the first
okay.
to come forward to do that. Thank you.
Okay.
Yes.
My second presentation has to do with the winter storm PACS reimbursement opportunities. Mr. Pierce, please.
Mayor, thank you very much. After the work session that we held a couple of weeks ago, we reached out to folks at FEMA and the South Carolina Emergency Management Division and the Office of the Adjutant General. And I've had an opportunity to speak with Lee Crager from FEMA, and she's traveled here to spend some time with us today. And then also with us is Derek Becker, who's the Public Information Coordinator with SCEMD. Also in the audience with us tonight are Nick Thorpe, who's the Region 6 Emergency Manager for SCEMD, as well as Katie Norris, who is the Individual Assistance Coordinator. And we did put in the agenda packet the public assistance applicants briefing information we received at USC Aiken. We have had a kickoff meeting with our caseworker, but based on some of the questions that we had at the work session, we wanted to have this opportunity tonight to have Lee and Derek with us so they could kind of walk us through the process, which we're in the middle of right now. So, Lee, Derek, I don't know who's going to lead off, but y'all have at it.
All right. Well, thank you very much for inviting us here tonight. I hope we can answer a lot of the questions that you have. Again, I'm Derek Becker, and if you have any questions, please, by all means, don't hesitate to stop us and ask us. It can be a confusing process, and thankfully, we have not had to go through this that often in South Carolina. That means we're a great place to live. So it's a good thing that we don't know about these programs, right? However, that said, when it happens, we try to work with the county emergency management directors and each of the municipalities to see what we can do in order to facilitate the process. I wanted to walk you through the whole disaster emergency response process. If I may, it'll take a very short amount of time, and then we'll get to where we are today, if that's okay. Whenever there's an emergency, emergencies begin and end on the local level. A house fire, a car accident, can typically be handled by a local fire department or a local police department. When a larger scale incident takes place, like, an ice storm or a major tornado outbreak or that H word, that season's coming up, the hurricane, local resources are taxed. It's overwhelming. It crosses county lines. Multiple jurisdictions are involved, and that's when you'll see city, county, state declare a state of emergency. The governor will declare a state of emergency, and that mobilizes state resources. If it looks like an incident is too large for the state to handle, resources within the state, mutual aid agreements with other states, the governor will then ask the president to do something very similar called a declaration of emergency. And that mobilizes federal resources. We contact FEMA based in Atlanta, and they do the emergency supplies. And we saw that happen in several cases here in Aiken, in getting the resources from FEMA, federal resources, here on the ground in Aiken County. Declaration of emergency, very different from what happens next. If it's so large that you can tell that the damage is so severe, we'll need federal assistance, the governor will then ask the president to do an official disaster declaration. So there's a difference between a declaration of emergency that the president issues and a disaster declaration, and this is where we're at right now. When a disaster happens, hurricane, ice storm, we're looking at two different types of programs that FEMA typically deals with. One is called individual assistance. That's the one that most everybody associates with that four-letter word FEMA. That's the direct assistance to homeowners, FEMA trailers, housing assistance, that sort of thing. The threshold, the general rule of thumb threshold for that program to be activated is 100 uninsured homes that have been totally destroyed, basically unlivable. And that's under federal law, the Robert T. Stafford Act. We just didn't see that with this ice storm. We've tried to get some resources out through volunteer nonprofits, local church groups, county emergency managers statewide have done an excellent job in maintaining databases and lists to see what type of help might be out there. Fortunately, most everybody had insurance, and that will always be the first step in disaster recovery for a homeowner. And we wouldn't be able, as the government, to go onto people's property without certain permissions anyway. So that's the individual assistance program, the FEMA money that everybody normally talks about and you see. It's reserved for larger scale disasters like a Katrina or a Sandy. The programs that we're talking about, and if you attended the kickoff meeting and the applicant's brief, is, and it's a little bit of a misnomer, is public assistance. It's better to say public infrastructure assistance, but again, that doesn't quite cover it. But public assistance is what we're talking about in 22 counties now. Lexington was just added late last week, and it's emergency costs over and above normal operating budgets, any uninsured damages to public infrastructure, so power lines, streets, roads, that sort of thing, and debris removal, and we're talking about the 85% on that. Now, if you're deemed eligible, the county and the state both have to meet dollar amount thresholds. Aiken County is about $560,000. The state is $6.4 million. Both the county and the state have to jointly meet those thresholds in order to activate these programs. We have clearly met that, and that's why we're dealing with the programs we are today. If you want to talk more about public assistance, the process now, you guys are here. This is still very much a very active disaster for us. When FEMA came in, they established what's called a joint field office, and they have about 100 folks working. I mean, they set it up overnight. It was pretty impressive to watch them do it, run computers and that sort of thing. And they're working jointly with the state in making sure that your applications and that sort of thing are being processed efficiently. So take it away.
And also in your packets, I've got a fact sheet, which really walks you detailed through the steps, and you know, more of a little color chart. So you'll see that one in there, and you know, that kind of just summarizes. If you see it on step two, which is kind of the yellow section, really where we are now, as Derek said, we just got through the applicants, the kickoff meeting phase. And so from this point on, we're really working with the applicants, so we work with the city to get your documentation together, and you are assigned a project specialist to come in and help with your project worksheets. It goes through review queues, and after that, the money is obligated. And once it's obligated, it goes to the state to begin the payout process. So, you know, right now we've only finished the meetings, and I believe we don't even have the project worksheet for the city written yet, but they're in the process of getting that documentation together to write it for any reimbursable costs. So I don't want to speak on and on. I know there were some questions, so I wanted to give you time to ask questions.
Mr. Pierce, could we repeat the names of each of the person? I got some of them, and some of them I met the other day.
That's fine.
Sure. I'm Derek Becker. I'm with South Carolina Emergency Management Division.
Okay, and Lee?
Prager with FEMA.
How's that spelled?
LEACRAGER.
And it was Katie North?
Katie North, NORRIS.
And?
Nicholas Thorpe.
Thank you.
And they have left their cards. I'm going to scan these, and I'll share them with council.
Okay, yeah.
And if you have any questions, don't hesitate to contact us after this meeting as well.
So. Yeah, I have a question. You stated if we are deemed eligible.
Mm-hmm.
When will we know if we are eligible?
Well, we are eligible for the programs. We've met, the county and the state have both met their thresholds. That's
you're assuring us of 85%?
No, not right now. Once your project, your paperwork has been submitted, it's up to FEMA to approve it.
Yeah.
So we're eligible for the programs, but each individual applicant has to be approved throughout this process. And unfortunately, it doesn't take nearly as it's not as quickly processed as we would like it to be. But it is a government program that we're dealing with.
Right. When you go through the review queues, they determine what expenses are eligible expenses and what are not.
Is that a year? Or is that a month? Is that?
No, the sooner you get the information back to us and we get the project worksheet, the faster it can happen. And it takes about 24 to 48 hours to get the money obligated once the worksheet's approved.
So we haven't given you the information yet?
No, we are still working.
Okay.
In fact, we had to have the caseworker inspect the debris piles, mm-hmm. to do an estimate of what the cubic yards are. We also have to, we provided documentation, and it's kind of like a mini audit. They match up the worker with the equipment with the hours worked, mm-hmm. and the hours that the equipment were used.
It's
the process
a bit like having your taxes audited.
It really is. Yeah.
It really is. And since tomorrow's April 15th, that's why I mentioned that. But it's designed, the system is designed to prevent abuse. And unfortunately, it does happen in larger scale disasters. And you can just Google a recent disaster to find where that has happened in the past. Once your project is approved and everything's good, actually, the city of Aiken and the county of Aiken, they're a little bit ahead of all of the other counties in terms of where you fall in line. Each person, each eligible entity, I want to say, has until May 9th to submit an application. I included a copy of what's called the Request for Public Assistance in your packet. We have 155 applications so far. We were hoping to get about 175. It's more than we had expected so far, particularly for the nature of the storm. But we're still open. We're encouraging everybody who might be an eligible government or eligible nonprofit to apply. Don't count yourselves out right off the bat. If you think your costs aren't eligible, by all means, contact us.
When you say eligible nonprofits, you're talking about homeowners associations, or what all is included?
The homeowners associations, if they are 501c3s in certain situations, they're eligible for certain things, such as debris on the roads. They won't. They're not eligible for damage to recreational facilities or anything like that. But debris on the roads and that type of thing.
About hangers and leaners and all those types of things?
That sort of thing should be deemed eligible, and that's one of the things that will be discussed once that particular homeowners association submits their application to the state.
But is that the only thing that's included under what you would call nonprofits, or are there other things?
No, nonprofits, obviously, Red Cross, any certified 501c3 that's active in disasters. The Baptist Ministry has it, for example, and there are a number of different 501c3s. Electric co-ops would count,
mm-hmm.
If they're government funded, sort of like Santee Cooper is of a sort.
Mm-hmm.
I think Aiken Electrical Co-op too is.
That's right. They are making an application.
But
yeah.
But all of those types of things as well.
Okay.
And just for the sake of the record, mm-hmm. we filed our request for public assistance at the March 18th meeting. At USCA, so it is on file.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
what was the name again of this form that you're still waiting on from us, though?
They're getting the documentation together so we can complete the project worksheet.
Okay, it's just the documentation for the request that we filed on
that. Yeah, and we do that in conjunction with the city, your applicant agent, and you guys will sign the form, you know, the state signs off, so you'll see the entire process and sign off that, yes, to the best of your knowledge, this is accurate information, the same way as we said tax.
But that's all going to be done by May 7th. Is that the date?
The deadline to submit this one-page application has been extended to May the 9th because Lexington County was added.
That's just to extend the application, but the documentation can come in beyond that.
But the process is still ongoing. Once you submit your application, that will go to FEMA to be approved, reviewed, approved, and then they'll create that project worksheet, and then you'll be assigned a project specialist or a caseworker, and you'll work through that.
I got a question. I might have missed it. You said utilities or infrastructure that is not insured?
Uninsured damages to public infrastructure. And a utility, if it was a publicly held utility like Santee Cooper or the Aiken Co-op, they would be qualified. But your SCE&G or your Duke Energies of the world, they can handle themselves because, number one, they are insured. You're absolutely right. And number two, they can typically shoulder the cost of all on their own.
We formally declared a state of emergency. Do we need to stay in that state of emergency until your process is done, or does that affect you at all?
It does not affect us. What affects us would be the governor's state of emergency, and by law that is in effect for 14 days unless she extends it. With this situation, that was allowed to expire naturally.
Okay, I don't know about ours. We just declared it. Was there a time frame in our declaration?
There was not.
So it would depend according to your local regulations.
And again, what we're going to file claims for will be any damage, any debris removal that are related to the storm. Yeah. So the 30 days from the storm ran, I guess it was March 12th. So that's what we're doing the worksheets on, is through March 12th to make that submission, because that's the 85% reimbursement rate.
And naturally, it would be nice to be able to anticipate the level of reimbursement. But I guess, is there any reassurance that we can count on that 85% if it's done before March 9th? I mean, how
it doesn't have to be done before March 9th.
I mean, that application has to be in.
One page? It has to be.
I know we've already got it.
One page.
We filed that.
This was March 18th.
We had till May 9th to file it, but we
did it on March 18th. The point is there any way to anticipate what the reimbursement rate will be?
They can't at this time. I don't mean to speak for y'all, but we're in the process of getting the documentation finalized for the regular work hours, the overtime, and the benefits package. In talking with the caseworker, they were very helpful to us as far as exactly what would constitute benefits that they would reimburse.
General rule of thumb for most scale disasters with FEMA, if you're talking percentages, it is 75% reimbursed by the federal government, with the state and local, typically the county, taking up the other 25% at a 12.5% cost share. Now, both the governor and the legislature are currently discussing whether or not the state will take on the additional whole 25%. We don't know the process yet. That's still being debated. As you can imagine, Columbia moves very quickly, so we are attempting to see what information we can glean from that. That's what you can count on. Now, with the post-Sandy debris, it would be 85% for debris collecting, processing, and disposal. The post-Sandy Relief Act.
That's where the 85% came in.
That's the
before it was all. Yeah, before Sandy, it was all 75%.
To do a faster job of debris removal.
So we may be getting. I'm sorry, Philip.
That's okay.
We may be getting reimbursed for the cost of keeping Smith Hazel open as a shelter and overtime and.
Yes, that's what we're going to make application for.
So all of that would be included.
Those emergency costs would be included, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they're under different categories. Uh-huh. We have the backstop damage replacement, since the insurance did not cover that. Also on the agenda tonight, we have the debris chipping contract for approval, too. And again, that will be we're going to apply for that to be reimbursed at the 75% rate.
You have days, based on our minutes, in terms of reimbursement, if things are filed within a certain window of time.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying we're within that window of time to get the highest reimbursement.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not when you file. With the Sandy Act, they are saying that you can get up to 85% for the first 30 days
right.
of debris removal. And then
yes.
the percentage goes down following that. So that's the time limit thing. It's the work done during this amount of time can be reimbursed at this amount. Work done after that date may be a different
right.
to try and
we get less
speed
the longer
up the
it
debris.
Takes.
Yeah,
right.
speed up the debris mm-hmm. removal process
right.
was the whole purpose in that. And it's a pilot program.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it ends in a couple of months. So we'll kind of see how... You know, how it worked nationwide for a few areas today.
And these are really Georgia, South Carolina, and now North Carolina. I guess they didn't want to feel like they were left out. These are the first states to be benefactors of this program since Sandy. There hasn't been that much of a natural disaster force nationwide, so this is new for the federal government as well.
What?
Go ahead.
Just curious with you, what are some lessons you've learned?
For me, go to sleep when I'm told to.
No. I'm saying because of this disaster, this is the first, so what, it may take too long, but I'm just give me some examples of what you've learned in terms of this kind of disaster.
Well,
as you work with communities to prepare for this for the next time, not we want the next time to occur.
Absolutely, and it can happen far sooner than we think. The biggest thing I would say that we have learned is that all of the programs that we work for, issues typically don't become issues unless you make them.
Mm-hmm.
The programs that are designed for reimbursement, the incentives for us to do what we do, I guess, the applicants or the auditors, if you will, look at cooperation. They look at whether or not the city worked with the county,
mm-hmm.
and the county worked with the state,
mm-hmm.
and they all work with the volunteer nonprofit organizations and all the public safety agencies work together, fire, police, EMS. Statewide, we did. And that's something that South Carolina needs to be proud of, the fact that we all did come together. Aiken County lost water, so we sent a truckload of water to Aiken County as
mm-hmm.
quickly as we could for various and sundry
mm-hmm.
reasons. We've lost a lot of our experience on the state level due to natural attrition and just it being so quiet.
Right.
I'm going to speak myself into a
mm-hmm.
disaster here. But it's a learning process.
Yes.
Every single emergency that this country faces is a learning experience.
And you have to train, even if there is no emergency.
Absolutely. And that's why we're here. That's why the State Emergency Operations Center is here. That's why you have emergency managers, very qualified and experienced emergency managers here in Aiken. So any of our programs are always going to be free and open to you, as open as they can be.
How are you working with DOT and what you're doing? You're talking about working together here.
Mm-hmm.
Is that experience FEMA and DOT in terms of working together?
It's been a big learning curve.
Two meetings with them last
mm-hmm.
week, but they're like any other applicant. You know, they're probably going to be the largest applicant of the disaster.
Okay.
When all their costs are said and done, but it was a very heavy debris removal disaster. I will say, since you asked the question,
right?
April 30th is National Day of Action for Prepare-a-thon. Emergency managers are the worst. So I'm asking everyone to do one thing. Just one. You don't have to go get a whole kit and do all this. Just do one thing to make sure your family or your neighbor or your elderly person at your church, what are you ready for next time? And if it's just making sure your grandkids and children know your phone numbers, because we all rely on cell phones and we don't know telephone numbers anymore, and you sit down and have that conversation with someone, just do one thing is all I'm asking you to do. And the better prepared you are, the better prepared your families and your churches are and your communities, the better prepared they are, and then I don't have to show up. And I love you, but I don't want to have to show up.
Lee Eustain, my counterpart in the state of Mississippi, she went through Katrina there, so she has a lot of experience working with us. Yes, sir.
I would just like to make a comment. This is my second involvement with all of you, and I've been very impressed with your positive attitude, your willingness to help us, and I'm really pleased to see you here.
Thank you.
I want to extend the question that Leslie sort of broached a little bit. If we had it to do over again, what should we be doing now to get ready for the next disaster? I know that we piggybacked on the county plan. Is that the right way to go? Should we have our own plan? Are there detailed plans?
Certainly we have a local emergency plan for the city of Aiken. I would say that the relationship and the clarification between state DOT and local,
mm-hmm.
The differentiation between state roads and locally owned roads needs to be a little bit more clarified. I think there was an MOU or something that was or was not signed, or an update of that. I'm not sure if it needs to go to that extent. I'm not the legal expert, but I'm a non-attorney spokesperson.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, having those meetings prior to, like this past week when it was absolutely beautiful, would be the time to do that, not right before the hurricane's making landfall, because all of the coastal evacuation routes end where? Here, mm-hmm. for Beaufort.
Mm-hmm.
You know, further conversations, take advantage of the training that the county puts on. I think Aiken County is very much involved in the state exercise that's coming up the first part of June. And if you guys want to play a role in that, if you want to tour any part of it, our doors will always, always be open to you. It helps us show what you do, because it is a confusing process when we get to this.
Did you say we should have our own emergency plan?
Absolutely.
As a city?
I mean, there will be situations in Aiken, in the city of Aiken, that will be the city of Aiken's responsibility, that it won't go to the county levels. Much like you have a fire department and a police department,
sure.
and the county has its own public safety utilities. There probably already is
an emergency plan in place.
It just takes a little bit of a review, and I encourage you to update it at least, you know, either biannually or annually.
What we piggybacked on with the county was the debris removal plan.
So for us, we work with all 46 county emergency management directors. That means there are about 49 different ways of doing things throughout the state. So you know, we're first name basis. We're very close with them. If there's anything that they do not have that you want, I would encourage you to work through them to get state resources and that sort of thing, because that helps you track your costs as well, as a whole.
Let me make sure I heard something right. What I heard you say, in fact, I think you called it a rule of thumb, is that there's a reasonable degree or a reasonable likelihood that we'll be able to recover 75% of our actual costs or our reimbursable costs from the feds, and the other 25% split between county and state will make all state.
Yep.
Right. But so there's a reasonable likelihood that 100% of our reimbursable costs will be recovered through this process.
That's the whole reason why we do this. Now, there could be something that you might not, all of your costs might not be deemed eligible, but the ones that are, you would be reimbursed with 75% cost share.
75 plus
25% state and local. However, that 25% is divvied up.
Okay.
So, and like I said, Aiken, you guys are ahead of the game in terms of where your application is and the process moving forward. So we hope to get everything done before June 1. As far as getting up all the debris, because that's when hurricane season starts.
Mm-hmm.
We've been very fortunate. So, any other questions?
Have you reimbursed any areas already?
Not yet. Right?
Appropriations, well, it was mentioned earlier that, that as the documentation is received by FEMA, that the funds can start to be obligated.
Yeah, Jenna.
Mm-hmm. There's a microphone up here for you.
It was mentioned earlier that as the documentation is received by FEMA, which again the pace isn't set by us, as we receive it, then the funds for eligible expenses, as they are documented and approved by everyone who has to approve them, then the funds surge. It's on a rolling basis. So we are starting to see funds being appropriated.
Sure.
I don't believe we've begun disbursing them yet,
okay.
because that's always a fun administrative process that I don't know too much about on the finance side. But it's, you know, something like a million and a half or so, last time I checked last week, had already been appropriated, and that's not a lot on the scale of this disaster, but we're seeing progress, and it's starting to work.
Good. Up until about 6 months prior to the ice storm, we did not have a dedicated recovery section at the state. Our newest director hired a recovery chief and therefore hired one person to work the individual assistance and the public assistance route, and we're in the process of bringing more staff on board
to process
all of that paperwork. So some temporary employees and that sort of thing. So we hope to get it where it's going very quickly.
Good.
But it takes time. We officially recovered from Hugo in 2006.
There you go.
So.
Quite a couple of clarifications, and Mr. Nicholas may ask. When the state picks up on roads in the city and hangers and leaners, that's all 100% to the state, and then they file to you, right?
That debris, that hours, that equipment costs, that would be added to the DOT's total as an independent agency or a state agency.
And the city won't see any of that cost?
No, much like if the city picked up debris on state roads,
which we
those hours, that equipment, that debris, where if it went to a city dump, would be weighed and that sort of thing.
We did that.
Okay.
Yeah. We did do that.
That would be added to your total costs.
All right.
So I think it's a mutual sharing of that sort of thing.
It was.
Whatever the state does, the city doesn't, just like the counties or whatever, the city doesn't see anything. The state files all of that.
Right. It all depends on what you submit with your application, with your scope of work and your project application.
Right. And Leland Colvin's letter covers that, that that's their expense.
All right.
Do we have a sense of how much money we've put out for this, Richard, yet?
We don't have an exact total, but it's a few hundred thousand dollars at this point with the two projects we have to approve. But understand again, much of that expense, it comes under the 30-day 85%. The backstop repair will come under the 75%. But again, we still haven't heard from the state. Mm-hmm. And so far, based on the numbers we do have, we've got reserve funds to cover the city's portion, even if we calculate that at 25%, which we think it's going to be less than that.
So far, we're looking at an estimated statewide $230 million of eligible costs. So it takes a while to sift through the dollar bills.
Well, the state's getting ready to adjourn for the year, aren't they? To
Not until June.
That still doesn't give us a lot of time, does it?
Considering the timeline, yeah, I see where you're going
right.
with that.
So.
We're confident we'll finish the debris collection. Some of the things we're looking at is there is an opportunity, too. There's money appropriated to the state for abatement. That would be conditions that the storm showed us could be abated through action. There's quite a number of folks, as I understand it, Derek Lee, you can correct me, but the loss of power caused a lot of damage. So a lot of folks are looking into this issue of generators and permanent generators or having generator connections. And that is something we're planning on filing for
mm-hmm.
so that we don't have the problem with, like, the Ross Stewart sewage spills that we've had in Hamlet North and so forth.
And that'll be the next step is a hazard mitigation program.
Got
and
it.
We've seen a lot of success at that program in this state. I mean, and even here in Aiken as a result of that.
Does FEMA or EMD have any guidance that they would issue to people on evaluating whether or not they want to consider additional power supply sources for their home? I've just heard the term today, a whole house system. Ever heard of that one before?
There are a number of different things that want to take your money out there. I can guarantee it. When it comes to generators, only if you know how to properly use them. For example, don't use them indoors. How many people die every year by using a generator indoors, including keeping it in the garage and having it sealed off. When we deal with this equipment, read the instructions. I hate doing it myself.
Mm-hmm.
It's that Y chromosome, I guess. I can't explain it. But properly doing that, if you can afford to do it, certainly take those measures. But most of the people that we deal with, their step is, where's the nearest emergency shelter? Where is grandma's house? Where's my out-of-state contact? And that sort of thing.
A lot of the disasters you've dealt with in the past year have lost electric power. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure that they've lost gas power as well.
Right. Well, there's always a run on fuel. Whenever there's a major hurricane headed anywhere towards the Gulf or the eastern seaboard, you'll see gas stations here in South Carolina crammed full. Heating and cooling, that's always an issue. 3 or 4 days of lost power, unless you have some sort of special medical need, is hard once you're going through it, but what we track would really be the 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 4 weeks or up to a month of power outages.
I use gas in the wrong sense. I mean, I wanted to use gas in the sense that it...
Oh, you're not gas heating?
Yes, it heats my house and so forth. And most of your disasters, that system is still viable, is it not, in some of the areas?
For the most part, it would depend on what connections you have and what system
sure.
that you have.
Yeah, okay.
But there are situations where you still have viable, a fireplace and hot water, and if you're on a well versus the city, those are always the debates you have to look at.
One cautionary note on the water heater, though, is so many of the modern natural gas water heaters have a microprocessor.
Mm-hmm.
So if you lose power, it's not going to tell the heater to turn on.
The more you overwork the plumbing, the easier it is to stop up the drain.
Bingo.
Just for curiosity's sake,
yes, sir.
Aiken's a fairly good-sized city, and we have a lot of resources. How do you find statewide some of these small municipalities? How are they coping? Do they have the resources to go in, or are they relying on state or county? Or
I don't think anybody has been fully prepared for just how significant this side of South Carolina was affected by this ice storm. If you go to larger scale cities like Dorchester County, for example, or Georgetown, even Horry County, they were hit. It looks like when you drive through certain sections that they were hit by a tornado. If you'll think back to the tornadoes of 2008, 2009, that's the type of damage that we've seen with this ice storm in many places of South Carolina. We did have several situations where other county emergency management offices went to help counties upon request, but that's the biggest thing. If you have a resource, if you have a need, ask. We're not just going to show up for you. We're not going to impinge on your territory, if you will, unless you ask us to.
And we apply for reimbursement for employee wages, straight time and overtime. It's for something or other. I don't know what that term is. Do we add to that the fringe benefits, medical and so forth?
Yep. Yes, all that.
Yep.
Loaded.
That would go into the emergency costs over and above your normal operating expenses.
Okay. Back to my other question. We have three in the city of Aiken. There's, the way I see it, there's three entities, and some of you were at the meeting I attended to the county and didn't know about the meeting held with the city. In the city itself, SCDOT picked up roads. And what I think I heard you say, what SCDOT did, they will file for that. Mm-hmm. And then what the city's done, they will file for that.
Exactly.
And then do we have to file, the city in this case, does it file to the state also, or do y'all automatically... All the legislature automatically sends us a check, or how does that work?
All of the applications are submitted to SCEMD. That includes Department of Public Safety, Highway Patrol, DOT, state agencies, nonprofit organizations, county government, municipal government. Everybody submits this one-page request for public assistance to SCEMD. That SCEMD then puts that application into FEMA's database. And that's when it will go through the review process, be approved or denied. And then if it is denied, you still have the option to appeal. And then you'll be assigned a special project worker, and you'll develop a scope of work. And that's when the money will start to flow.
And so that role, what you're saying is, once FEMA gets through and we get, 74.99%, then it rolls over, and the state then decides what you get between 75 and 100 or whatever. That
will be up to the governor and the legislature to determine whether that 25%, how that's going to be split. Most states typically do a 12.5% split with the applicant and the state. There are discussions, as there always are at this time, whether who's going to carry what, and looking and seeing if it's feasible for certain entities to take on a different percentage. Does that make any sense?
The next item, at the meeting you have with the city, did y'all discuss about the property owners associations?
We did not. There was a meeting at USC Aiken on March 18 that did talk about.
Okay. But that wasn't the kickoff meeting.
No, sir. That was the public information.
Ms. Hughes is here tonight, who's president of the Woodside Property Owners Association. I don't know if there's anybody here from Calmia. I don't see the president here, but there's two POAs in the city. About 16% of the population are 4,800 people, so there's obvious an interest there, and they also have turned in, I think it's RPA, Request for Public Assistance.
Right.
I think you've received both of them, because I think they've gotten questions back, or we know that it went in. One of the questions I have, I think it would be valuable if these two POAs could hear directly from y'all with their questions. Is it possible for your team to meet with them?
The best thing, if they've been assigned a project specialist, is to work with that person, because I don't have their bylaws and everything to go through.
Mm-hmm.
So if they've already submitted that and they've got someone they're working with, that's going to be the person to help inform them.
We don't have anybody yet. We just submitted it Thursday or Wednesday.
Okay, well, we can check and see where it is in the system as well. Once it goes through, they...
So is that the person that needs to come to to the property owners and discuss it with them, or does your team need to show up there?
They will contact whoever's on that form as a point of contact, is who they'll get in contact with.
And when should they kind of expect somebody to ring their chimes?
As soon as the paperwork is processed, and it's on a first comes the first serve basis. Once the project is submitted, or once the RPA is submitted, and then FEMA is reviewing them as they get them. But it's an extensive process. They have about 100 folks, 100 people here right now, give or take, and they're going through all of the applications. They're conducting kickoff meetings as well, much like you went through with all 22 other counties and municipal organizations. So they're getting to it. It doesn't take nearly as it's not as quick as we would like it to be, but
Well, I understand the time. I want to be sure, you know, you're here tonight discussing with us.
Yeah.
And then when you go down to the next level, it's a different team.
Mm-hmm.
There's a caseworker that will be assigned to Woodside's account.
Yeah, and it will be probably somebody different. And let me apologize to you in advance, because you'll get sick of hearing from them by the time this process is over with. So, and then you'll think back, it's like, remember that meeting when I asked why haven't they contacted me? Yeah. And seriously, it does get to that point, because FEMA is very, very detailed when it comes to
reimbursement,
filling out the paperwork.
One of the POAs, the other one has been contacted already, and ours hadn't. So if we don't hear somebody, in a week or 10 days, it's time to call you?
By all means, please do, and I can always double check on it to see where it is.
What is that form call?
This is a request for public assistance, and there's a copy of it. I put it in your blue SCEMD folder.
Okay.
Is this a two-way street where the individual can inform the POA where the paperwork is, where the process is?
That whole process.
Collecting information also. Okay.
All right, so
by all means, I mean, if you have any questions, this is the time to ask. Absolutely.
Okay. What I'd like to do while y'all are here, Ms. Hughes would like to read into the record. Our letter and our application is in the city minutes, and I would like Ms. Hughes to read that while she's here, and she has a copy to give to you, just to be sure that it gets there. So,
Ms. Hughes, why don't you come forward, please?
I did not get one of those packets.
If you have a spare package, give one to Ms. Hughes, or I'll give a mine, whichever is the case.
Sure, I have everything in here. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
And we have more copies of any of that information.
Yeah. Lee, thank you too, and Derek and your whole team. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick.
Thank you.
Very educational. We appreciate it very much.
Good evening. My name is Nancy Hughes, and I am the president of the Woodside Plantation Property Owners Association. And what I would like to do is read to you the contents of a letter that I wrote on behalf of the Woodside Plantation Property Owners Association and submitted to the South Carolina Emergency Management Division, requesting reimbursement for the costs that we incurred for cleanup after the ice storm. And the contents are as follows. Attached is form OMB number 1660 -0017, request for public assistance that I received from Tommy Thompson, Director of Aiken County Emergency Services, and completed by me. Woodside Plantation Property Owners Association is requesting reimbursement from FEMA for costs incurred as a result of the ice storm from February 10th to the 14th of 2014. All roads in Woodside Plantation are in the city of Aiken. The city and the county are responsible for emergency, medical, fire, water, sewer, stormwater, and school buses in this area. The Woodside Plantation Property Owners Association supported the city of Aiken crews in removing debris from main access roads for emergency services. Once access was established, the Woodside Property Owners Association supplemented city crews in clearing the right-of-way on major roads. The work was coordinated with the City of Aiken Public Services Director. The cost incurred by Woodside to remove debris dangerous hanging branches and broken trees has been $303,931.60 to date. In addition, Woodside is requesting reimbursement for costs incurred for individual assistance for common area storm damage. The amount to date has been $63,342.62. Our total request for reimbursement for costs incurred related to the ice storm damage is $367,274.22 to date. In addition to the request for public assistance form, I also attached a summary of our cost and pictures of the debris removal. On behalf of the Woodside Board of Directors, we sincerely appreciate your consideration for reimbursement for debris removal. Thank you.
One thing that I want to just put into the record so that we're all clear about who's doing what, when, where, why, how. We did not pick up any debris in the common areas. We did provide the emergency service. We do have a contract with the residents of Woodside to pick up the yard trash. That's part of that $14 a month fee that's on the water bill that comes every month. So we have gone through, and if I'm not mistaken, Tim, we have finished the second pass through Woodside.
Yes.
So we have gone through and picked up debris from residents, but not the common area. So that's why
that's what we do.
You're asking for this
exactly.
difference, which is the common area.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's.
So let me understand something here, if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm.
My other question, well, first of all, the funding. The reimbursable funding will come to the Woodside Homeowners Association. Is that right?
This is money that we've spent.
You spent. I asked a question earlier at the last meeting, I believe, regarding the pickup. That was done by a private contractor.
No.
I thought it was told to me that we had a private contractor to go in, pick that debris up, take it to the fairground. Am I mistaken?
Which pickup are you speaking of?
Not in Woodside.
Not in Woodside.
Not in Woodside. In Woodside, because that's not SCDOT right away. It's not a city street. It's a gated community.
Right.
What we have is a contract with the residents to pick up yard trash. So we did it in 2004. We did it again this time where we've gone in and picked up the debris pursuant to the city ordinance and the fee that the residents are paying. So that documentation, along with the documentation of what we picked up in 2004, is what will be submitted to FEMA to justify the request for reimbursement.
So for the common areas, Woodside hired a private contractor.
Right.
You did. Okay. That's what
we did.
I knew I heard a private contractor.
Right. And they
so you hired the contractor, and they removed it. All right.
Yeah, if you look up on the – I had Miss Sarah put it up there. It's at the bottom, and talking to the emergency director in the county, and I think it's Tommy Thompson.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. He said, even though it may not get it, it says, in addition – is requesting reimbursement incurred for individual assistance. And I don't know if there's any of that available, but he suggested we write it in there anyway, and he told us it wasn't available. But if you don't ask, you sure won't get.
Exactly. And for individual assistance, I said it earlier, would be $100
And this is recreation type stuff and so forth. But we did want to put it in there anyway, and so that we have it. And I think I think it's Mr. David Johnson has turned in the one for Cowmere Landing, and he's already had a call back on something, so I know he has a worker. If we don't hear in another week or so, Ms. Hughes will give you a call and see what's going on.
Ms. Hughes, I have a question for Ms. Hughes. How long did it take that private contractor to clean up the area? Just curious.
We had two contractors in there.
2 weeks?
No. One took 2 weeks. The other one took probably another couple of weeks.
Okay.
We had one come in to do emergency stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Another one did tree repair and things like that.
Just curious. How many homes are out there roughly that we're talking about?
About 1,850.
Okay.
Now, and just for the completeness of the record as well, we had city crews at work pushing the piles together. City crews picked up, but then we also had assistance under mutual aid with the city of Greenville, and they spent about a month in there picking up debris.
from the resident.
Yeah, and you know, for the record, we all work together.
Right.
Because
I know that.
And I don't mind. Coal Creek was out there almost that same day because literally you couldn't get in and out of the area at all. So if an ambulance had to show up, a fire department, he would have to have four wheel drive and drive in the grass or something. So I think there's a mutual agreement with all of us that we helped each other to.
That's right.
The city and everything, and the volunteers as well.
Well, in fact, the clearing of the streets and the pushing of the piles was done by Glenn Parker's crew from Parks, Recreation, and Tourism.
Oh, my point for asking the question is that I know what your streets look like, and if you've got debris on that street, only one car can pass
at
a time. So and that's happened, I know, with a lot of our streets, but yours in particular, I know. And if you've got it piled, sometimes you can't even get through your.
That's right. And that's why the driveway.
So you went ahead.
The purpose was to address the resident area in front of resident properties. But we also recognize that residents would not be able to get in and out of Woodside if we didn't clear the common area.
Right. So you handled that appropriately in terms of it would have taken longer if we had to come in. You probably would have still been sitting on the debris. But
maybe.
Anyway. But certainly the actions needed prompt attention, and that's what you did as an association to get it done. So.
Richard, can I ask a question for just for better understanding? When other cities, municipalities come to the aid of, in this case, Aiken, I guess for their work, they file the same paperwork with FEMA to get reimbursed?
They're actually sending it to us, and we're making that part of our filing.
And
right.
I mean, this may sound awfully cynical, but what's in it for them? Why are they taking some of their own people and sending them down to Aiken for so long
I think
and putting the wear and tear on their own equipment and all that stuff?
Well, I think it's a fair question. I mean, we helped Greenville out when they had a terrible ice storm in 2006, and we were up there for almost a month. Greenwood, when we made that call, they actually were glad to help. It was kind of a slow time for them, so the crews were kind of looking for something to do, so they were happy to come down and help us out. And it's just kind of a sister city understanding and the good relationship we have with our other cities that they wanted to come help.
And if I may, every county in the state has mutual aid agreements for various other services throughout the entire state. In addition, all 50 states are connected to what's called the Emergency Management Assistance Compact. And that's, if they have a need and the state has a resource, first come, first serve, and that's how it goes. I deployed with Assist Mississippi during the oil spill, the number of areas that they've had, and so on. And we do it because that's why we're in public service. So Greenville will help out Georgetown, as you can Aiken, send support to neighboring counties and beyond. So that's why we do it.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Hughes.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Okay, under old business. Item 1, approval of appointments and discussion of appointees to various city boards, commissions, and committees. Mr. Pierce, please.
Mayor, thank you very much. Councilmember Price recommended Charles Matthews to replace Terry Provost on the Planning Commission. That term would expire December 1, 2015. She also recommended the reappointment of Joanne Saunders to the Arts Commission. That term would last through April 11, 2016. Angela Key to the Accommodations Tax Committee for a term that expires March 25, 2016, and Helen Simpkins to the Senior Commission with a term that would expire March 14, 2016. For council consideration tonight is the appointment of Charles Matthews, Joanne Saunders, Angela Key, and Helen Simpkins.
Thank you, sir. Do we have a motion and a second?
I so move.
For approval.
Second.
Who seconded?
I think Philip did.
Philip. Okay. Any discussion? If not, show of hands, please. All in favor? Passes unanimously.
Nominations.
How about nominations? That would be on the agenda for next meeting. Any? Okay. Item 2, second reading and public hearing of an ordinance to approve the sublease between Aiken Aviation Enterprises and Hilton Head Flyers, LLC. Mr. Pierce, please.
Mayor, thank you very much. The title of the ordinance is an ordinance approving the sublease of property at the Aiken Municipal Airport. Mike Laver is not able to be with us. He spent 10 days
directing air traffic at the municipal airport and is not able to be with us. That included, apparently, at 3 a.m., handling a situation where Phil Mickelson's pilot went off the runway, went into the tarmac. That no damage, everything was fine. It didn't obviously help Mr. Mickelson with his game. We had a plane direct from Switzerland that flew here. We also had executives from Volvo and just countless other corporations that were out there. So he regrets not being able to be with us today. Did call and ask that council approve this sublease, and this is for the purposes of having a flight school at the airport as a continuing operation. So for council consideration tonight is second reading and approval of this ordinance to approve the lease agreement.
Okay, do we have a motion for approval?
Second.
Okay. Any discussion?
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. We don't deal with the airport very often. Is this going to result in a new building being built for this new company, the Hilton Head Flyers?
No, sir. I'm not aware of a new building being built.
Okay. Question number two. Where do we stand on a private person putting up a building for a hangar, adding hangars to the airport?
I'm not aware of any request from a private person to build a hangar. Are you, George? No, we don't have any request right now.
At one point when we were talking about it, we had to do a survey of the airport. Had to go to FAA, and then that came back. So, but if somebody wanted to build a hangar, they would just go to you, George?
Well, I've had inquiry about that, and so I went and talked to Bud Coward about it. And apparently, because of the FAA requirements and the national security issues that go with it, it's evidently nearly impossible, according to Bud Coward. But I've had somebody that asked me about building a hangar out there.
I mean, if somebody wants to send a letter to me, we'll be happy. We've got a consultant that works with us. The FBO is interested in some new construction out at the airport, so it would be a good time.
But I remember it was an item on that we discussed a couple of years ago.
We did, but we've never had a written request. I've had some follow-up conversations with a particular person who was interested in that, but I never had any proposal or, you know, schematic drawings or anything.
Now, we have, so the approval that we sent in 2 years ago to the FFA has come back approved. We did a plot plan update with the little star, you know, the geodetic circle and all that.
George is going to come up to the microphone. We've actually are updating that. It's the plan for the airport.
That was done about 2 years ago.
But we were updating it, though.
And we needed a survey, I think.
Well, that's what we did 2 years ago, but we've added some things.
The FAA requires an Exhibit A to be completed. I think a couple of years ago there was an update to the site plan and all, but it didn't go to the depth that it needed to go. What they were looking for is title searches, you know, clear property for any of the boundaries, etc. So that is on our plan for request for grant, the entitlement grant that you get annually. We've done a pre-application conference call with the FAA and our consultant to gain the funds to, you know, oversee that. And that's what our consultant would do. They would manage that process for us and do that. And then we have some other projects that we're, you know, talking with them about that were part of that. And actually, during the work session on Thursday, I can provide a little more information on that.
Okay, if you would, because I didn't think we got approval back yet on it.
We had to do a new Exhibit A because it wasn't to the depth that they wanted, and we have the requirements,
okay,
and it will be completed.
That's what I recall. And your update was Thursday. Good.
Things go so slow with this airport. So we asked for something that we really didn't need. We asked for something that we didn't need instead of asking for something that we needed.
I can't tell you what's in the past.
Right.
I can tell you what the FAA is telling you.
Before your time, we'll let it pass. The minutes of the Aviation Commission seem to reflect a little concern about drills, emergency drills. And I don't get from reading the minutes that there's
that there's a desire to do any kind of emergency?
I'm talking with Charles Branco to discuss what he and we, as representatives of the city and the Center Fire Department that has actually got the jurisdiction. And it was just a question that the commission started wondering, what is our preparedness, what would we like to do. So we're engaging that as kind of a current topic, and so we have not completed that discussion yet, but we're finding the facts, and we plan to,
I'd encourage that, because obviously, anytime you have an aviation accident, there's somebody looking for somebody to blame, so.
That's right.
That's all my questions, Mr. Mayor.
What was the purpose of the survey and so forth a couple of years ago? Are you familiar with that?
It's a FAA requirement in order for us to qualify for the FAA grant money.
That's not my understanding.
That was two things. Wasn't that the extension of the runway, and what is that landing system, ILA?
Inchman Landing System.
But you have to have a plan for the airport. That is why we do the Exhibit A, and if we don't have the Exhibit A that FAA approves, we won't qualify for the grant money.
So, but I thought the reason that we did the request for survey was because somebody did want to build a hangar, and we said, well, we can't deal with you yet because the FAA requires that we do a survey of some kind, and that's why I thought we did. That's my memory of why we did the survey.
Okay. Well, and again, we're updating that at FAA's request. I don't have a request for a hangar. George doesn't either.
I'm surprised you don't.
I don't.
Yeah, okay.
It's hard to answer something that I don't have in hand.
We would certainly talk with anybody that was interested.
Absolutely.
In the hangar, and there are things we can do that would facilitate that, I'm sure.
Sure.
This brings up an interesting question. Suppose somebody does propose a hangar and an associated business office, park 10 airplanes and then have a little bit of a business, maybe a flying school, as this contract is. Who owns the building? It's on our property, right?
It depends on the location. The fixed base operator has a lease area.
Yes.
So if it was going to go in that lease area, you would have to have not just the vote of council, but the approval of the fixed base operator. Of course, the airport's larger than the fixed base operator's leased area. Mm-hmm. So that would be a question for council. Typically, these requests, though, we would float by the Aviation Commission to have their input on the proposal.
Well, this doesn't answer my question, Richard.
Okay.
The FBO leases the property, even if we build on the FBO property, who owns the building? It's not the FBO. The FBO would have to lease it, or how does it, what's the, how do you work that if the FBO doesn't want to take possession of it or doesn't want to include it in their responsibility?
Okay, and I really want to answer your question. It depends on where the building is going to be. We own the dirt.
Yeah.
We lease an area to the FBO. So the FBO has an interest in that land that is the leased area. So if it's proposed to go there, as I understand it under the agreement, we can have Mr. Smith research it again. The FBO would have to give permission for that. If it was to be on an area adjacent to the FBO lease space, that's something council would vote on because you own the dirt. And by state law, just as we're doing with this sublease, you approve leases for the property. But we're actually the property owner.
And I'm not exactly sure this is accurate, but if council will remember, the older members of council will remember, there was a hangar out there that we leased to Mr. Wyatt. Mm-hmm. And the city leased that hangar to him. And that was a lease agreement, and that was outside of the FBO's area.
Mm-hmm.
And we leased that property to Mr. Wyatt, and Mr. Wyatt's company built the hangar there. There's a documentation in there. I think that once the lease ends, the city is the owner of that hangar.
Right.
That's correct.
That is right.
Is that the question you're asking, Steve?
Yeah, basically.
The FBO improvements that they make in the FBO leased area becomes the property of the city.
To the city, okay. Eventually. Right. Yeah.
When the FTO property reverts to the city when he leaves.
That's right.
That's right.
Everything becomes the city's.
If it becomes a fixture to the real estate, the city becomes the owner of it eventually.
That's correct.
So
eventually
it's for the our benefit to get as much built out there as possible.
Sure.
It's an economic decision.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, as long as it's quality construction, it's something that has a lifespan that would outlast the lease. I mean, we wouldn't want a problem improvement, you know.
Okay.
Thanks.
Ready to vote. We got a motion and a second. Any other discussion? If not, show of hands, please. All in favor? Passes unanimously. Item 3, second reading of a public hearing of an ordinance to annex 1.2 acres at corner of Hudson Road and Lindsay Drive and zone it RS6, residential single family. Mr. Pierce, please.
Thank you, Mayor. The title of the ordinance is an ordinance to the annex to the corporate limits of the city of Aiken certain property owned by D&M Enterprises of Aiken and to zone the same residential single family RS-6. The site of the property is up on the screen for council's reference. You did unanimously approve this for annexation. It is contiguous. Planning Commission voted unanimously to recommend the annexation and the zoning request. So for council consideration on second reading is to approve this ordinance to annex this property at this location and zone it RS6.
Thank you, sir. Do we have a motion and second for approval?
So moved, sir.
A second.
Okay. Any discussion? If not, show hands, please. All in favor? Passes unanimously. Item 4, second reading and public hearing of an ordinance to amend the zoning ordinance regarding electronic reader boards. Mr. Pierce.
Thank you, Mayor. The title of the ordinance is an ordinance amending the City of Aiken zoning ordinance regarding electronic reader boards. The particulars include adding a definition of electronic reader board, setting standards for electronic reader boards that include zoning districts where they are allowed, how often the message may change, and how any transitions of message may occur, requiring signs to adjust automatically to ambient light conditions and limit their brightness, require these signs to turn off in case of a malfunction. The Planning Commission reviewed this. They voted unanimously to recommend these revisions to the zoning ordinance, and we do have the red line markup that begins at page 177 of your materials on how the ordinance will actually change. Council approved this on first reading unanimously on March 24th, so tonight for consideration is second reading and adoption of the ordinance.
Okay, thank you, sir. Do we have a motion and a second for approval?
I move approval, Mr. Mayor.
Second, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. All right, discussion?
I just have a question on signs. It has nothing to do with electronic boards. Can I ask that?
Of course.
Okay, thank you. I had to get some work done on my automobile because I wasn't paying attention as I was driving around looking at debris. And I got it done at the new Kendrick Auto Place, which is behind Floyd and Green. And they don't have a sign. And I asked them about that, and they said that you can't have two monument signs, and the only sign I saw out there was a for sale sign. Can anybody on staff address that?
Mr. Evans could speak to that. Mr. Duariette, could you come up to the microphone?
I mean, it's in a tough place if you think about that particular location. You've got to go left off Silver Bluff, or you can get into the shopping center, but
it's where the old Parkers.
Yeah, yeah, and they had a sign.
Yeah, billboard at one point.
They did.
I'm trying to remember the facts of that case, and honestly can't recall, to be honest, if there is a problem preventing them from having a sign.
Yeah, somebody said it was a two-monument sign is the phrase that he used, and when I drove out, the only sign I saw was a for-sale sign for that large lot.
Well, if we can't resolve it tonight, if we can just let Mr. Evans take a look at
the situation. Sure, yeah, there's no great hurry, obviously. I'd like to see a new business have an opportunity to be recognized.
They have business after hours there Thursday night.
Is there a grandfather clause? Because Parker used to have a approved or unapproved sign out there with a little arrow on it, if you recall. It wasn't a high-tech sign at all. And I don't know if that was legal or illegal, but if it was legal, would that be a grandfather that they could put a sign out there of some sort? Check into it and see.
Thanks, Ed.
Okay, we've got a motion and a second for approval. Any other discussion?
If not, show of hands, please. All in favor? Okay. Passes unanimously. Item 5, second reading, public hearing of an ordinance to amend the fiscal year 2013-2014 budget to replace Citizens Park Field 5 backstop damage by winter storm packs. Mr. Pierce, please.
Mayor, thank you very much. The title of the ordinance is an ordinance amending the budget of the City of Aiken for the fiscal year beginning July 1, 2013 and ending June 30, 2014. Again, we did make an application to our insurance carrier when we had the backstop at Citizens Park Field 5 damaged by winter storm packs. They have denied paying any of the claim. We've gone to bid. The bid is $29,781.83. Since it's greater than $25,000, we did advertise this for sealed bid. And since that exceeds the authority council has given to me, that's why we brought the ordinance to you for consideration. You approved this at the March 24th meeting, and so we can get this backstop fixed, hopefully, before too much more of the baseball softball season proceeds. We would ask that council approve this for us. Of course, we will seek reimbursement from FEMA and the state.
Okay, thank you, sir. Do we have a motion and a second for approval?
I so move.
Second.
Discussion.
Just a question. Is this the only item in all of the money we're spending for the emergency that we need to have a motion to change the budget?
No, sir, because you've got under new business the chipping
one, yes.
Yes.
But, I mean, how about the expenses of a normal payroll, which obviously are much higher than they would be if we weren't in the emergency?
I mean, we could have the city attorney look into that. We were actually submitting reimbursement for that.
And we are for this, and we are for the chipping.
Yes, sir. Right. This is actually a purchase, though, that we had to go to bid, and it exceeds the $25,000 amount, so that requires a city ordinance as we read the purchasing.
So where are you getting the extra money then to pay employees for their overtime and so forth until you get reimbursement from FEMA?
Well, we're advancing that money out of the budget. Yeah. Are you talking about the overtime? Because we had to pay the employees.
Yeah, the normal pay is in the budget, obviously. Mm-hmm. But
we budget for overtime. We're exceeding that amount right now, but we're seeking the reimbursement.
So. Yeah, but we don't need to do something like this for the overtime.
I was not aware that we did. We can have
okay,
the city attorney.
That was my question, because you know we've got two items that are expenses associated with the emergency, but
they're involving vendors and not our in-house workers.
Okay.
Well, eventually, if there's a spending gap between what gets reimbursed, we'll probably have to vote on that, right, to make up that gap.
Well, we're not aware there's going to be a gap. If anything, we're getting back not just the regular time and overtime, but the benefits as well. So we should be in good shape.
Well, why was the insurance denied?
I think they considered it, the legal term is force majeure, you know, a natural
act of God.
Disaster, right? Yeah, they used to call it act of God, the patchwork.
Did you get a formal declination, denial of the claim?
We got I think we were notified in writing, yes, of the denial, because we're putting that with the FEMA.
Forward me a copy of that?
Sure.
Sometime tomorrow or this week?
Yeah.
Yeah, we have to have a denial of it, or we can't make the...
The claim
for reimbursement.
I just
one of their rules.
I mean, that's an area I have a little bit of expertise in, and I'm just curious.
I think you do.
Okay, we got a motion and a second for this. Any other discussion? If not, show of hands, please. Okay, passes unanimously. Under new business, item 1, approval for temporary sign placement, SCENG/SCANA scanner. Neighborhood Energy Efficiency Program. Mr.
Mayor, thank you very much. Gerald Freeman and Scott Dealey are with us here tonight with an exciting program. Stuart, did we have the map that we could put up on the laptop? If we could pull that up, please. Council will recall that in Crosland Park we received a 3-year grant from EPA for weatherization of the homes, and we did dozens and dozens of homes in Crosland Park. And Amory Langston, who's with us here tonight as well, and I had an opportunity to meet with Gerald and Scott and talk about this area that's shown on the map
It's roughly an area from Morgan Street over to Schofield. It's as far north as Hampton and I think as far south as Edgefield and then a portion of Barnwell as well. They're here and can provide the particulars, but the gist of this program is for SCEG representatives to come in and weatherize the homes in this area and help folks reduce their power bill. What council needs to approve tonight is, as part of this event, there's a kickoff meeting April 22nd, and council is certainly invited to attend. That's going to be at Smith Hazel Recreation Center. And it starts at 6 p.m. and will go till 8 p.m. And they want to place temporary signs in the neighborhood to encourage a good turnout so folks can understand that they can get their houses weatherized, updated at no cost to them. So for council consideration tonight would be the approval of placement of this signage in the right-of-way.
Okay, thank you, sir. Do we have a motion and a second for approval?
I so move.
Second.
Okay, discussion? Not to show of hands, please. All in favor? Passes unanimously. Item 2.
I have a question regarding that. Are we doing any more stopping, just putting the signage up? Are we getting...
If you could come to the microphone, then we'll get you on the record, Scott. Jill?
I'm Scott Neely with Scana Corporation, of course, and I have with me Gerald Freeman, who's the manager of our neighborhood energy efficiency program. He's probably the best person to tell you more about the details.
Okay. And your question again?
A question is, are you doing anything more than just putting the signage up in terms of getting the word out? What additional things are you doing?
In the neighborhood, we're just putting signage up, but of course, in the homes, we will install the energy efficiency measures in the home.
Any other advertising or promotion?
Get the word out.
That was the right question. Are you doing anything different than just putting the sign up to get the message out to the citizens?
Absolutely. What we're doing is we're mailing out a mailer. It's called an introduction letter. Mm-hmm. It goes out to every resident in the neighborhood, and it lets them know of the program, lets them know what we're doing in the home. And it also invites them out to the kickoff event so they can learn additional information about what we're doing in the neighborhood.
Any TV, radio?
No TV or radio advertising. It's pretty much just a mailer, uh-huh. And we're hoping that it will be some word of mouth as well.
Could be put on Channel 4?
I mean, I'd like to see you go on to...
it's a radio station.
94.7. A lot of people in that area listen to them, and... You can go just for 5 minutes to go on air and tell them to look for that letter so they'll understand what it's for and be more receptive to it.
And Scott, the cost is very small, but it would not...
Yeah. Sure. Well, one thing
they'll
we are
let
doing...
Come on as a, that could be a public service announcement.
One thing we are doing that we mentioned in our letter to Richard is that we do plan to do some canvassing of the neighborhood and passing out flyers. So that's a beyond, you know, the mailers and beyond the signs also. That's another avenue that we've decided. Of course, the event is on April 22nd, so we're fairly close to the date of the event.
Very close.
And the letter's on page 203 of the agenda packet.
So when will the letters go out?
The letters actually have already gone out. They went out on the 8th of this month to approximately 488 residents.
And any residential customer within that project area is eligible. Of course, the area was selected based on some income qualification and census data, but any customer, SCEG Electric customer within that area is eligible. And all of you should also have received or will receive shortly a letter at home just inviting you to this event and letting you know about it.
Okay.
I'm not sure if you've received those yet.
But would y'all go one step further and maybe have Mayan or someone from Aiken Standard put something in there?
What we'd probably have to do is talk with our public affairs folks before we made any commitments in that regard. But I'm sure we can certainly talk with them. Absolutely.
We just want to make sure they know.
Sure. Absolutely. And that's our goal, is to get the word out, because we know 100% of the residents won't accept the program,
But as close as we can get to 100%, we want to get there.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask a question. Certainly, I agree with what you just said. Some of them won't. But would you have a follow-up after this? After somebody sees it in someone's home or something, you know, they might have a different idea about getting it done in their home.
Right. A lot of people are leery about
is it ongoing thing
in the house.
Could it be an ongoing thing for at least another month or two, maybe?
Well, usually it takes us a couple of months to complete the neighborhood, and we make several attempts while we're in the neighborhood.
Okay.
So not only do we make one attempt, we make a second attempt. We also make phone calls if we can get in touch with them by knocking on the doors. We also have what we call a last chance door hanger that we put on their doors, letting them know we're still in the neighborhood, we're about to leave. So we try to make several attempts before we leave the neighborhood and they don't have an opportunity to participate.
That sounds very thorough to me.
One other thing that we noted in the letter to Richard requesting the council's permission for the temporary signs, there are actually two kinds of temporary signs. The first type of temporary sign is the sign that would be placed in the neighborhood prior to the kickoff event. The second type of temporary sign were little yard signs that we would install at the locations where we're currently working. And it lets folks know that we're in the neighborhood on that particular day as another incentive to get more folks to participate.
And where exactly will you place the sign?
The little temporary signs are about the size of a traditional or typical real estate sign, and our intention was to put those basically in front of the residence where we are working on a particular day.
That would not be in the right-of-way, so that didn't require city council approval.
Just wanted you to know about that as part of our plan.
So you've spoken to some residents.
I'm sorry.
Spoken to some residents already that have agreed to allow you to put the signs in and come and do the work in their house.
We wouldn't put a sign up unless the resident was agreeable.
I mean, so you have someone in mind. You've already identified.
Well, this is what, the fifth neighborhood in our service territory where this has been implemented. We've had two neighborhoods in Columbia, two in the Charleston area. Okay. So we do have somewhat of a track record of sort of how the program has played out in the other areas, so that we're basing what we anticipate to happen in Aiken based on, you know, those other neighborhoods.
How many homes are you targeting, Scott?
We are targeting approximately 488 residents in Aiken.
Now, once you, let's say it's successful, will this program expand into other neighborhoods or anything like that?
Absolutely. SENG has a 24-county service territory. So what we're doing is we're looking at and evaluating neighborhoods all over our service territory. So eventually we will make it back to Aiken, but again, we are looking to expand within all the counties and some of the cities and towns within all of our service territory.
Gerald, it's my understanding this is some of the first work that SENG is doing in the western part of the state.
Absolutely. This is the first time we've done Columbia, Charleston, and now we're branching out above and beyond the what we call the larger metro areas and coming to the Western District.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I need a motion and second for the approval. Oh, and they voted. Okay.
I think we approved that. Did we not? We had
a
motion and second. We did.
We did.
You did. Okay. All right. Item two, first reading of an ordinance to rescind ordinance 042720009A regarding leased properties in Crossland Park owned by the City of Aiken. Mr. Pierce, please.
Mayor, thank you very much. The title of the ordinance is very simple, an ordinance to rescind ordinance number 042720009A. The copy of that ordinance is on page 214. That ordinance allowed the leasing of property in Charleston Park. This ordinance would rescind that ordinance. The intention would be that the City of Aiken that owns property or houses would not lease any property in Crossland Park. So this is for first reading and consideration.
Okay, thank you, sir. Do we have a motion and second for approval?
So moved, Mr. Mayor.
Discussion?
Second.
I have a question. When will this begin?
this would not affect folks that are currently in the homes that are leasing or leasing to own?
Just future residents.
That's right. There would be no more leasing of city-owned property.
Does it rescind the residential rental agreement that was the attachment to this ordinance?
There was an Exhibit A to the ordinance.
Well, let Gary answer. Gary and I discussed.
It rescinds that ordinance.
Mm-hmm. Including the attachment.
This ordinance rescinds the ordinance 0472009A, and that ordinance had a lease agreement, the homes of
as an attachment, yes. So it rescinds that.
Rescinds that completely.
Now, does it deal with, there are, what, six people living in leased homes there now?
Mm-mm. It's five.
Five?
We actually did one eviction for a house on George Street.
Okay. Now, does that, the lease was only for four. Is this the other lease we have with the lease to option to own?
That's right. Mm-hmm. The one on Cornish Street.
The one's on Corning, one's on George.
Cornish Street.
Cornish, yeah, Cornish. And
I think the one on George was actually part of the CDIC. Managed properties. That's the four that were managed by CDIC.
That's the four, okay. There's two on George Street.
Right. There are two on
now,
George Street.
Now, and Mr. Pierce and I discussed this earlier, and I discussed it with Mr. Smith, and I was very specific in the email I sent. What we need to be sure is that these leases don't get renewed. And as who's in here says there'll be a letter written, will that come from the city attorney or city manager? Or
who? The city manager. That was right. Paragraph
you'll send
two.
It to CDIC, and then they'll advise the residents.
Right.
And it made it specific that, you know, they stay in there until the leasee moves, dies, or whatever happens.
Right. Or their lease expires.
Yeah, or the lease expires.
Yes.
And once it expires, there's no moving cost or anything. The lease is done and they're gone.
That's right.
So we can put them out on the street without a place to go?
No. That's not what the ordinance says.
I know what the ordinance is saying, and I know what the law says, and I know what Reggie is saying, that once that lease is expired, we can't renew the lease, so they're in there without a lease.
Well, it would be an expired lease, right? They wouldn't have a right to be there if the
right,
lease
so we could evict them.
So they would be thrown out.
Right.
And where would they go?
Is it leased for a certain period of time, or is it an open-ended lease? The way I read it, it was an open-ended
lease. One-year lease.
Yes, right.
1 year lease.
Okay.
Yeah, the way that, when we talked about this previously, the way that I understood it was that the folks that were in there could renew the current lease, but there would not be any new leases issued for new tenants on city property. But we were reassured, I think it was the Horizons, but reassured that nobody that was in a house was going to get thrown out of a house.
Right.
Well, again, I could pull the lease. The lease may have a right to renew in it. Did you check that, Emery, about the renewal of the lease?
It's a matter of what we want it to be.
Can we table this for the next meeting?
Well, can I just answer the question at second reading?
Mm-hmm.
That'd be okay. I'll bring a copy of the lease and make sure they've got all those.
I got it right here.
Well,
is that the lease they signed?
It's the rental agreement. That's attachment A to that ordinance.
I mean, isn't the question what we want it to be? Not
well, I think our intent is to get out of the lease business. I mean, that was the whole intent of it, and certainly. You know, if you come up and tell me that just because we did something today on April 14th and somebody is going to be thrown out of their house on April 30th, I would say let's be compassionate and extend it for a short period of time until they can find another place.
Right.
But not an indefinite period of time. I mean, the goal is, you know,
I agree.
We got enough trouble running the city. We don't need to be in the leasehold business and building houses and so forth.
Well, let me say that we got involved in the business of housing for a reason. And if we had not gotten involved in the business of housing, we'd be labeled as a huge slum community. We got in the business to get Aiken to where it is right now, and certainly we've helped a lot of families.
I understand. And
we're
applies,
continuing that process.
And that applies to Tool Hill and Edgewood and so forth, but we got out of control with what were wonderful plans for Crosland Park. We went in there with the right idea and then lost control of it, and it's an absolute mess.
Well, we failed, in my opinion, to
repeat a model that was successful, and that was Tool Hill, in terms of buying property in blocks.
Yes.
And improving that area.
Yeah, I agree.
And so not having done that, doing it sporadically with a house on this street, and anyway, that's, we know what that's about. But
yeah.
Well, but the issue is the leasing, and we got two other leases that are purchased option, and I've asked Mr. Pierce to look into those. If I'm not mistaken, those houses would have been priced anywhere from $95,000 to $105,000. You know, four or five years ago when the lease was done, and we'll look at that in the near future. You know, that's, I don't think that's right for the lease option on a house that's not worth that much. And we got to look at these. And that's why these leases get you in trouble, because they go on so long, type thing. The houses vary, and it could be the other way. They could have leased it at $60,000. Now it's worth $100,000. Well, what do you do? So I'm trying to work this through so that we can get out of the lease business. And the tear down and the building new houses, we're still working on that, and I think that's where we can do some good. But the leasing of city property is just a headache for us. It's a headache for any city.
Reggie, you said, you made a comment that they go on and on and on, or they can go on and on, but yet it's a year lease.
I don't know what the lease rate is. Lease on there.
Richard just said it's a year.
It's 1 year.
It appears, you know, and I hate they don't go on and on. I mean, you can cut them off after that year. You may.
I hate to issue opinions on unsigned agreements. And this is an unsigned document.
Well, we do have this, a second reading, so
this,
we can.
This does say it's a 1 year lease. And what would have happened is if there's still a tenant in there after the 1 year term has expired, then that means they're a holdover tenant, and they're there for a month-to-month basis.
Do they automatically offer month-to-month as an option there?
Yes.
At the sole discretion of the tenant?
Well, we probably need to look at this.
You need to give them a chance to look at it before.
Well, I understand.
Basically, a holdover tenant usually can stay in a place as long as both parties agree that they want him to stay there.
Both parties, right. Mm-hmm. I just think all I was pointing out is that we need it to be however we want it to be. I don't think, I mean, obviously we have a lease here that's in place, but whether we want to renew it or not, we need to decide. Whether we want to let it go month to month or not, we need to decide. At some point, every one of those leases is going to expire, and the council needs to know what he wants to do with those expired leases. That's all I'm saying.
As the first paragraph in Section 1 is presently written, if this ordinance is passed by City Council, theoretically the current tenant could be kicked out. Mm-hmm. If that was council's desire,
that's what I said.
And I don't believe that was really council's desire.
No, that's not our intent.
But if they have a lease and they're current on their month to month, you can't kick them out.
Yeah, you can.
I don't care what kind of law you pass.
It's hard to do, but you can. And I don't think we necessarily.
You probably can, but we're not going to. So why waste time even talking about it? Right. We're going to let them go to the end of their lease.
You know, you don't go back. And I said from day one, and I wrote the email to Mr. Smith, we're not going to kick anybody out. If it goes to month, maybe we need to write that in here. But once that individual that signed the lease no longer does it, then the house is empty. And that was the intent. They would, you know, once they move out, and they could be, they've been in there 5 years in some cases, so what's the, you know.
I don't know, we've carried a lease for 5 years?
Yeah, this goes back to 2009 when we bought these houses.
Yeah.
The one on Corning.
Yeah.
One of them.
The one on,
I mean, the way that I just understood the ordinance to be written, it grants the city the right to throw the people out at the end of the lease term. The city is not saying that they're going to renew the lease, that the city's going to renew the lease or offer a month-to-month option. And all I'm saying is we need to decide if that's the way we want it, because this ordinance is a little stricter than maybe we would want it to be.
Yeah, it was established to allow those folks who had credit problems to do some credit repair and turn around and purchase their home. And that's why the year was agreed upon. And frankly, I think that given what has happened with our economy, the timing that we instituted that was good, because people had problems in maintaining their jobs, their hours were cut back,
and they had some credit problems, and it took them time to do the credit repair, and some of them are currently living in Tools Hill right now, so that worked for that area.
And I don't know that it's worked for Crossland Park. I mean, that first person, Security Federal, came to us and said, look, it's likely that this one person is going to have good credit at the end of the year. I didn't support it because that's what we experienced nationwide. But we went and did it. But I don't know that anybody has repaired their credit to the point of being able to buy a house in Crossland Park. I think they're all still tenants.
Let Mr. Smith review the actual contracts, and if it's the intent, Les, and I said this several months ago, was not to throw anybody out.
No one wants to do that.
The intent is when they no longer want to lease that house from the city, and it's a city lease through CDIC, is then it would revert back to that. And that was my email to Mr. Smith. So let him read that between now and the second reading.
And I just want to reiterate what I was trying to say again. We need to determine how we want it for this ordinance, because what the ordinance says is that they will remain in the homes they are leasing until their lease agreement expires. That could be April 30th. And by the ordinance, it doesn't say unless the city decides to let them go month to month, or unless the city decides to renew it, or unless the city does anything else. It says they'll stay there until their lease agreement expires.
Well, I can't support this tonight based on the ordinance, and I want to talk with Security Federal Bank about how that is going with some of these tenants that's there.
I think there's two ordinances involved. This one is the pure lease houses that were destined, the people around, and then someday they were going to be renovated or torn down. There's another ordinance that was leased with an option to purchase, which is a different issue. So there's, when you ask the question, Leslie, there's two things to ask about. And on the lease to option, there's three of those, Richard. Now there's only two left. We have one house.
Two.
And those are leased to purchase, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they've been in there close to 5 years, too. So
I know one of them has. I don't know about the other.
The other one's been a little bit less than that, but it's not far.
There's one on the list, 1160 Cornish.
Okay,
that's the one.
Well,
that's 5 years.
I wish I could get really emotion about one tenant having a 5-year lease, given all the problems, but I can't get that emotional about one person at this point. And is there a motion for Mr. Mayor?
You have a motion and a second.
Well, if you want to
motion
continue,
and a second.
Continue to, for a second reading.
We can pass it. And, well, we'll have a second reading, so
yeah,
we
second
can decide
reading
on that.
Yeah, that'd be on the 28th.
Let's make sure we understand what the question is, though. What is the question?
The question is, we had a model that we used in the three or four other neighborhoods, and it worked. They were much smaller neighborhoods, and then we moved to a neighborhood of that large, and the model hasn't worked very well. We made a number of other type leases and things, I guess, to tide people over, like Les is saying. These have been going on. These are 5-year-old leases. And the others, this is a straight lease. We wouldn't send the people out until we needed the house, or they left. And that was my email.
Or when the lease ended.
But we weren't going to throw them out. Now, if we have to change that to say that, if you say it's a month-to-month, they could lease it month-to-month for another 5 years.
Well, the question is not about what the lease says. The question is what this ordinance that we're considering passing says. And it says they can only stay there until the current lease expires. And all I'm saying is we've got to figure out, is that what we want to say, or do we want to say is they can stay there until that lease expires and with the city granting a month-to-month option, you know, some other additional wording.
Let's let Mr. Smith work on it. My intent was not to throw anybody out of the house.
Well, I'm not talking about, he can read that lease all day long. What I'm talking about is the ordinance.
But the ordinance is not passed yet.
I know. But that's what we're talking about, whether or not we're going to vote on.
And if it needs to change, if you want to continue it, the reason I bring this up, there's been four or five of these items, and we had some others. We've transferred sometimes property back and forth to Aiken Co-op three and four times around here. And all of it has to do with Crossland Park. The other area went smooth, and this one's just been floating around. And this is one of the last couple of items to get straight in the bookkeeping. And that's all my whole purpose is here, is to get our bookkeeping straight.
And Richard, get out of the memo business with you. I'm agreeing with you about getting out of the
Is it council's intent to let someone who is presently renting a house theoretically stay in that house as long as they wanted to, so long as they were paying the same monthly rent that the city agreed to accept when the first lease was negotiated with the current tenant?
No, not as far as Richard's memo says. Therefore, for council consideration, is an attached ordinance to end leasing of Crossland Park city-owned properties.
But I'm hearing council say they don't want to kick out a current tenant.
That's what you're hearing.
And theoretically, that tenant could be there 20 more years.
Well, I'm not saying that. And if you're not willing to say that, then let's just forget the whole thing, because people will stay there forever.
Yeah. I mean, the folks, when they signed up, they knew it was a lease.
That's what I'm saying. We've got to make this decision.
Without reviewing the leases, my assumption would be that every lease that's currently outstanding has already expired, because they were only one-year term leases. And so
there's also that last page of paper on attachment A that they signed that says the city can ask them to move out.
That was if you were going to rehabilitate the home that they were in.
Yeah.
But
it assumed you would find them a temporary spot to live while that was going on.
It's still the same question. Are we going to make people leave or not?
Well, I mean, that's...
Are they paying their way? Is it a problem with finances?
I want to talk with Security Federal.
If they're paying their way, what's the problem? We've got people in houses.
But they're not buying the house, Mr. Mayor.
And I know it, but we've got other houses, too, that we're not selling. So at least we've got people in the homes. And as I recall, at least my view was, that was one of the things we wanted to do initially, is to get people in the houses so that others would see that, hey, this is a viable thing. And so we agreed to have some leases.
Well,
and maybe I'm wrong on that, but I think that was part of the...
I think we backed into the leasing, Mr. Mayor. I think in the beginning the plan was that we would buy these houses and have options on the houses, and we would buy them for a very low price, we would put some money into them, and we would sell them at a price that was very competitive.
Right.
And that ended.
And what happened?
When the pricing went up.
That's right.
Mr. Mayor.
These people still have an opportunity to go into DuPont Landing, which is building affordable housing as well.
Someone left here with us the City of Aiken's residential and anti-displacement.
Council had asked for that.
But I haven't read that, and I'd like to read that. And I think, based on my scanning, there's some information there that may help us with answering the question. And the other question is this such an urgency that we need to pass this on first reading tonight? Can we schedule it for the first reading at the next meeting?
I have no problem. I'll bring it up because I knew it would be a ticklish issue.
Okay.
And I withdraw my motion.
Okay.
And whoever seconded it, they'll withdraw the second.
Steve seconded.
Withdraw.
Okay.
I move that we continue this item.
For the next meeting.
Okay.
Next meeting.
And I'd like the city attorney to weigh in on whether this applies to our program at Crossland Park.
Okay. It will.
We'll have copies of the leases and everything at the next meeting.
It has, and it will.
Are all the leases in the Crossland Park, the ones we're talking about, identical? The four or five?
They follow the same form.
Those, and then there's a second ordinance that we have a way out of the other ordinance, and we are working on that, because that was a lease with option to purchase. Mr. Pierce is duly working to see if the other two remaining people can ever pay for it. So this deals with that. So we have a motion.
Okay, I'll second it. Any discussion?
Carry forward.
This is
continued.
This is for
continue. First reading. Next meeting.
Yeah, continue it.
Already did that.
Show of hands, please. All in favor? Passes unanimously.
One thing we can do, we can sell these houses to CDIC also. That's one thing you need to think about, Leslie. We can do that, at a reduced cost to help them.
Richard, you made a statement when I asked for Gary to weigh in on the applicability of these two documents, mm-hmm. and I didn't only hear half of it.
That's okay. We have actually relocated some folks and paid their relocation expenses, and it was very expensive. I think it was one or two people.
I understand, but I've always said, and this partly answers it, I just wanted to know on what basis we did that. Now,
Because we had somebody in a house they were leasing that we displaced to renovate the house.
I still don't understand why we would have to do that, but if you...
It's a HUD regulation.
That's a law.
Yeah. Wait a minute. This is not a HUD program that we got into, as far as I know, from Crossland Park. We got into this program here within the city with the effort to do, as I mentioned earlier, we were going to buy houses at low prices, fix them up, and sell them.
Right. And again, it's a government-owned house, and our research reveals that the regulation applies.
Well, I wish you guys would be more honest and open at the beginning of these programs, because I'm getting tired of finding that the rules have changed because we weren't told the right information.
And this is just getting frustrating. Again, Mr. Dwyer, I can tell you that I've shared your frustration from time to time, and I've been nothing but honest and open about this program. And again, this was a program that was in place when I became city manager.
I understand that. I can assure you that nobody told us.
We operate from an honest and open standpoint.
Right. Nobody told us when we started that once people are in, you got to pay to move them. Nobody told us that.
And again, we could go back and check the minutes, but I'm telling you now that we would have to do that if we displaced somebody who was renting property that we own.
I read the minutes pretty carefully. I don't recall seeing that. Okay.
Item 3.
Take
ready?
It down.
First reading of an ordinance to amend the FY 2013-14 budget to approve a contract for chipping winter storm packs debris. Mr. Pierce.
Thank you, Mayor. The title of the ordinance is an ordinance amending the budget of the City of Akron for the fiscal year beginning July 1, 2013 and ending June 30, 2014. After inspection by the FEMA caseworker, we're now ready to go forward with the chipping and debris. The anticipated cost for the low bid was $1.84 per cubic yard. We're estimating at this point, we actually have collected over 120,000 cubic yards of debris. So at this cost, that obviously exceeds my authority under the budget ordinance. And that's why we come to you for approval, as you've heard the presentation by FEMA representatives tonight. Since this is the debris removal, that will either be reimbursed at the 85 or 80% level plus any compensation that the state would approve. So for council consideration tonight is first reading of this ordinance to allow us to proceed with the chipping of the debris. We will open up bids for the hauling of the debris later this week, and we'll bring that on the 28th.
Okay. Do we have a motion and second for approval?
So moved, Mayor.
I second.
Okay. Discussion?
A couple of questions. Now, the money that's not reimbursed, that will come out of the reserve funds at the end of the day?
That's correct.
So 2 years from now, when we don't get 10% of this, that comes out of reserve fund.
I don't know that it'll be 2 years from now, but anything that's not reimbursed, we would have to pull from the reserve.
And that's what we've been saying about the other things we've passed.
Yes, sir. That's correct.
Now, I did a little math here. So the guy's going to move in on day one. 30 days later, he's going to leave, and we're going to write him a check for $195,000 and change.
He'll be due the money, that's right.
Yeah, so he'll be gone in 30 days, and whatever we have left shouldn't be much in 30 days because he won't be here for another 4 to 6 weeks.
We really believe we'll have all the debris. We'll have finished the third pass by that point. 30 days from now, we'll be done.
Okay, good show.
Thank you.
Okay.
Richard, I have a question, and this may be impossible to get done. But this is simple for someone like me. Is it possible to give us a sheet? I know it's in the budget already and you have to look for it, but a sheet of the running tally.
Yes.
Of what we're paying out, and that we,
yes.
Instead of us asking you every time how much did we pay, you know, how much, just have that in the packet and we know how much we paid.
Sure,
and
sure.
What we owe.
Yeah, we're happy to do that, of course.
Yeah.
With the submission sheet that we talked about with the
right.
FEMA folks, you know, my plan is to provide that to council. That'll give you the itemization.
Right. Okay.
We haven't finished it.
Okay.
Yeah, we're still working with the representatives. Quite frankly, we're discovering that this go through, there's a lot more that that's potentially reimbursable that we did not seek in 2004.
Okay.
It's really a good thing. This pilot project is going to prove to be very helpful to the taxpayers, it sounds like.
There are several items that we discussed tonight that we'll have to pay out, so I won't have to call you every day in the next few weeks and ask Richard what to do. I'm going to kid
you. You can call anytime.
I know.
That's not a problem.
All right.
Okay, we need to vote on this. Show of hands, all in favor? Passes unanimously. All right.
We'll bring that back for second reading on the 28th.
Okay.
James Matthews is in the audience, Mayor, and I apologize to Council for not having it in the agenda. We did post notice that he was here tonight and wanted to address Council about Edgewood Subdivision, and he's here.
Okay, sir.
All right. James.
Good evening.
Good evening, James.
Council.
How are y'all doing?
Oh, yeah, to wait so long.
Huh?
I don't know. The comments that I have tonight does not pertain to me. It pertains to the people of Edgewood. A lot of them are very dissatisfied with the city, and I'm not here to talk anything negative to you all. Because we went through this process several years ago. So we got some old issues there. And they'd like to know where the relocation of the recreation facility, the one that y'all had in the water bill, all those items. But to continue on, not to make it too long, some of the citizens are concerned about how you did Tools Hill just as well as Crossing as y'all were talking tonight. And the second issue was the water bill increase, storm drains. We still have that problem. We need to correct that first. If it takes 2 years, let's do it. Get the curbing, the gutter, the drainage, move the water. It's all over that whole area. And I can give you a list of streets. I spoke to Richard about it, and I also spoke to Gail. And you can start at the 500-600 block, 700 block of Sumter, Saluda, Hampton, Hart, Camellia, Buford, Sunday, and Marlboro. If you go over and look at the way the water and the drains combine, it's not good. It causes massive erosion, flooding of the yards. And the people are upset because you raised the water. And that's not fair. You can go right there on the corner of Camellia. There's three houses that takes the curve. One house sits very low. The city came and put gravel in front of the man's yard. Never went back. Just spread it out. You can see where the water runs down into the other person's yard. This is just a few of the issues. But the main issue that I'm upset with is the house that you purchased on Kershaw, the Edgewood project. The city owns this house. There is debris that the city employees took out. It's been there for over a year. But you can tell us as residents of the city of Aiken to clean up your yards and keep it clean. The city owns this house, so it's a double standard rule. It's not right. And then when they say if it was on the south side, it wouldn't be like that. But it's on the north side. And I want y'all to actually just take a tour and just walk through Edgewood. I don't know how y'all want to do it. You can get together on the bus, whatever. But it's going to be hard, very hard, to convince the residents of Edgewood that you're going to do it right. So my suggestion, and I spoke to several of them, I need signs. Like your voting signs, if you want to vote for me, vote for you, or whatever. Every 6 weeks, put that sign out for Edgewood residents to attend these meetings. Don't stop. Keep continuing doing it every 6 weeks. If you get one, the first meeting. You might get four the next meeting, but do not stop. That's the only way you're going to be able to gain trust for those residents. And my last comment is, I have support from ACON, which they agreed by following, you know, the neighborhood agenda that you had set forth for them. And I told them myself personally, in the Edgewood Project, you call it a low income and moderate neighborhood. I would like the word low removed from Edgewood, because I don't believe if you're going to put a $100,000 house there, it's low income. The size of the lot for a $100,000 house, I don't have no backyard. It's too close. Take the three lots, make two houses. Throughout the other neighborhood, when you get to the 50 houses, the year that they were built, and it was back in the 50s, they're the older homes. That's the section I live in. The 70 homes, they got larger yards. They're a little bit more spaced out. That's what I would like to see the city of Aiken do for the residents of Edgewood. Thank you.
James, this is startling to me, because I haven't heard most of what you said. Have you communicated this before to
yes.
staff or to
yes.
people? Well, we've done. I know the city's done so much there, and it seems like all I've heard has been pretty good. You know,
no,
but obviously it's not.
It's not.
And I'm wondering what happened to the communication.
Well, 10 years ago when you came through and did the drainage, and I begged, I said, it's not going to work. Don't do it. Especially right there by my house. And to make it even worse, to say this, and it's in the minutes, that I asked for the street sweeper to sweep Hampton Avenue for the debris that comes down from Smith Hazel on those streets. I haven't seen a street sweeper. You can go by there tomorrow and look at it. We got a big drain tonight. All those drains are clogged. I don't know what happened. But that's the biggest issue, because the pipes are not big enough to carry the water. That's the main issue right there, is drainage. And I have contacted the city before. They came out with their pumper truck and blew out the drains and cleaned them. It's always been an argument that that's a state road. The state will come and clean your drain. But I pay you every month, the member, you know, the residents of Edgewood says, and there's no action. You look at the 600 block of Sumter, look at the potholes in the road. Very, very disgusting. You want to come in and build a house? Nobody wants to move in that neighborhood or any section of Edgewood until it's corrected. But I'm willing to work with you in any shape, form, or fashion to get the residents back on your side.
I wonder if staff has any comments on this.
Well, we have several. We have been in discussion with Aiken Corporation, and we actually have a proposal from the executive committee that we're going to bring at the meeting on the 28th. And I know Emery Langston, as our special projects coordinator, has been working with folks in the subdivision and actually offered for Mr. Matthews to come attend those meetings. And as I understood it, he declined to participate.
Well, I think he's attending the meeting on Wednesday.
Okay.
Having a meeting on Wednesday.
Oh,
I'll be there as well.
Good. Well, good. And again, we do need this discussion, Mayor. I do know that George and his group in Stormwater, we looked at a potential comprehensive view of the stormwater in that entire area, which included Jake's place, and it was fairly expensive. George, do you remember the total cost for that study?
Yeah.
You'll have to come up to the microphone so we get on the recorder. And as you make your way up, the lot that we just purchased in Edgewood, I think we purchased less than a month ago. If there's a cleanup issue, we'll follow up on that. I wasn't aware of a cleanup issue.
Let me ask you a question. Is there a plan, step one, step two, step three, four? As James has said, if everyone agrees with it, that the flooding aspect is the worst thing.
we do have an opportunity with the lots that we have in the area, Mayor, to put in stormwater runoff abatement measures, and we are looking at that. What we are trying to figure out is where Aiken Corporation is going to be interested in spending its housing money, because we have several lots in a block immediately across from our Kershaw Street facility that could be developed with new homes. What we did do is we built the three homes by Meredith that were sold before they were finished being built. Then we had the economic problems. And what we were doing is looking at several different options there. George, do you remember the comprehensive stormwater study?
It all depends on the
scope,
the boundary scope that you want to set on the project. If you look at just the properties to build, making the assumption, and that needs to be challenged, and we are actually going to do that, that the existing structure is adequate for the area, you would look at building new homes on the existing property such that they do no harm or do no negative impact on existing infrastructure, assuming the current infrastructure works. To evaluate a larger area was in the $30,000 to $40,000 range just to do a hydrology study. And then if you get into a larger area, it could actually get into, you know, 100,000 plus. So what we were trying to do in working with Emory to kind of define the area, send out some requests for proposals to kind of give us an idea of kind of the ranges of monies that it would take if we just kind of look at this, if we look at this, if we look at this. And then we'd have, you know, real information to come back and say this is what it's going to cost. You know, to start with, one of the things that I have asked my stormwater crew to do is to go out and just confirm, you know, are the pipes, you know, clear? And it may be that, you know, if there's a lot of debris coming down from, you know, the hill, so to speak, you know, if you don't prevent that, you have to keep cleaning it. And that is something that, you know, our stormwater crew should do. When you find a problem area, you should, you know, we will keep an eye on it. So we've just been informed of that, and we're just now getting started on it.
The other thing that we've done as well with the properties that we have there is we did a request for proposals from builders for possible new construction in Edgewood. And again, we were looking at a cooperative effort because Aiken Corporation has money in the bank. They can do a concept plan. We can study the area to see what would be appropriate construction for about $25,000. And again, we're looking to Aiken Corporation to partner with us, since we don't have that money in the bank right now. Mm-hmm. But we have looked at these three different proposals, and that was submitted to the executive committee last week. And again, we can discuss this in more detail the 28th. So, James, if you would come back with us, we'll have folks from Aiken Corporation to talk about it at that time.
Let me just say that, George, at the least, right now, we can do this drainage.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. That's now.
Yes.
So let's get that done and rule that out in terms of whether that's a problem or not.
Yes. And we'll see what condition it is and then kind of assess, we'll keep an eye on it and mm-hmm. see, you know, how frequently it has to come back. And you start looking for, you know, causes to see how you can, you know, minimize the amount of maintenance you do, but you do maintenance to the extent that it needs to be done.
Right. And again, this information that's been shared with council today was shared with me today as well.
Richard.
So we do have some good action items to go forward.
The site for development, is that going to be the Jake Place area, that street, as far as building new homes? I know when I joined council in 2011, that was the big talk, and that's what the residents there thought was going to happen in the very near future, is the development of Jake Place and housing.
That is not the scope that Emory and I have talked about. Yeah. That would be the big dollar study if you included Jake's Place.
Right. And again, the city doesn't own that land. That's actually owned by a private landowner. We were looking on Kershaw Street, where we do actually own some lots and could redevelop.
But Jake Place was talked about.
It was. You're right.
Well, see, that's the area where you go over into the 700 block, which is the left of Sunday as you're coming from the old SC&G. All that area is dilapidated. Some of these houses, nobody's been in 5-10 years. My suggestion is tear it down, if you know, and build new houses. That's the idea why we want the word low removed from our neighborhood.
Right. And again, Mr. Beamer, we'll need to have the property maintenance inspector, did any of that property that's in the city limits, have him inspect that. If that's
James, that land that you're talking about, is that in the city? Is that city property?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Edgewood is in the city. But you have state
I just meant that area. I wanted to make sure that area.
Not all of it.
It is.
Okay.
But Jake Place is not.
It's not, right.
Is it Jake Place, the property on the east side of Jake Place, is that in the city? I don't think so.
I don't know that, but that it was always a part of the issue.
We'll check that, Mr. Everett. And again, the property inspector will look at the properties that are in the city limits in Edgewood.
Well, if you build rent houses in random places, you may have the same issue we have with Crosland Park.
We actually have a concentrated area. There's a block that we own the land.
But before you do anything, I would like y'all to take a tour, a serious tour.
Sure. At this point, all we have is a proposal for what new construction would cost. It was somewhere in the realm of about $75 a square foot. We have no plans to go forward with the construction yet. We just have those proposals. Now we're doing the feasibility.
But that's why I say if you look at the lot, what the three lots that you're talking about on Kershaw, it's too small. I wouldn't pay that for that small of a lot, not even a half an acre. The house would take up the whole yard. That's the proposal that the residents are saying, you know, take the three lots, make two houses out of it. You can go back and look at the ones on Saluda, how small their yard is.
Right. And we did that at Tool Hill where we bought small lots, then combined them. And again, that was the plan going forward in Edgewood, not just to build back on the existing property line.
My earlier comment was there were some great lessons learned from Tool Hill.
Correct.
And we have to transfer that information to other neighborhoods that we gained from Tool Hill. There are serious problems, and we've got to correct those problems. I hear you very loudly, and I think council does too, with these taxpayers who feel that they're paying taxes but they're not getting equal value for their taxes, and that's all they're asking for. Give me a safe community, a clean community, and one that I'm proud of based on my tax base. It may not be great, but I'm paying taxes.
Exactly.
So.
The second thing that's what's really bothering them is Bilo. You know, we're losing another grocery store. We don't get no business on our side of town. You know, and we don't understand why. And they point their fingers back at the city and say, well, you got a Zaxby's on your side of town. No, we do not. From the west side.
West side. But actually, Bilo is moving into the Reeds building.
Right.
Reeds is going out.
Right. But we only have one grocery store.
Right.
We don't have anything on that side.
But that was Reeds' choice to go ahead and phase out. But Bilo will still be the grocery store over there.
Well, James, so. You know we can't direct that.
Right.
You can't tell.
You had no control over that.
I wish we could.
Right.
Well, the other thing that we preach in this town is shop Aiken. And if the volume of business is such that businesses see that volume, they're not going to move. So it's important for the folks, me, you, to shop north side. Because if there's that volume is not there, those stores can't stay open. They can't keep their staff. So you've got to shop in the neighborhood to maintain the viability of those businesses. So.
And James, I'm willing to join in, and I know we talked about a cleanup effort in Edgewood, and I'm willing to participate in that. And I know there are several things we need to do to show people that we have pride in our neighborhood, and that's removed some of the debris in the yards and have some of the cars that don't run anymore, junk cars, to be removed from the property, because all of that brings down property value. So you have to show people that you take pride in your surroundings so that they will be attractive to the area. So I'm willing to participate in that effort, and I'm sure whatever the city needs to do to help us with that, whether it's to bring the dumpsters, Tim can bring the dumpsters so that we can get a good start, and we can schedule some Saturdays to do that. I'm willing to participate.
Okay. Well, the science is the main thing, I believe, that's going to actually have to work. Mm-hmm. You know, you can put it in the mail. It won't do anything because of the way they feel. But maybe if you put the signs out the week before the meeting and take it up, you know, the day after. But we have to keep pushing them to get them for their cooperation to work with you all.
Yeah.
But
when you said the signs, I'm not very clear.
Well, it's like a voting sign. You know,
the meeting sign.
We just don't need three or four signs. We need to put out throughout the whole large neighborhood.
Okay.
You know,
we need a plan too, first, I think, so that we have something to talk about.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
This is what we plan on doing.
And when George, when you do this drainage evaluation, getting that information to the community, what we've assessed, feeding that constantly as we get up to date information always helps as well.
And we could do a targeted mail to the neighborhood. That's not a problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you, George. Wait just a minute. George, don't run off. I think Mr. Pierce has mentioned about the Aiken Clark money. That's a loan from the city, so we all control that money. I guess go back about 10 years when that was put in, the new curbs and gutter were put in. But prior to that, did everything drain in the neighborhood?
No.
Still had a problem before?
Still had one. They had to go back and recorrect it due to Jake's plane and Ashton Oaks.
Oh. My question, I've spoken with George on this. If we put in some kind of detention retention, it's obviously going to hold water.
Correct.
And is that what we want in the neighborhood, or do we want to fix the drainage properly? Because that's what's going to happen. If we do any kind of remediation, it won't be detention because there's nowhere to drain it, right, George? I mean, you're going to dig a hole in the ground, so it's going to get deeper.
Everything that goes in the... What I've seen in the storm drain pipe design, all of that goes into the storm drains, goes down to Jake's place, because that's the natural flow of water. The localized area off of Kershaw Street, it receives sheet flow from the sheriff's parking lot over the, you know, the road, and then into that low-lying area. And that low-lying area does a lot of absorption of water that doesn't get into the storm. Some does, some does not, but a lot of it soaked in. So you'd have to handle kind of the existing watershed with the properties you have such
that
you're not contributing extra water to a taxed stormwater system. So if you construct, it has to keep everything plus fix, you know, what maybe is being contributed from across the street that, you know, that just sheds.
Not just the sheriff's department. That drain starts at Union Street at the railroad track. Comes down all the way to Kershaw.
It just comes from that direction.
Right, it comes from there. And all of Smith Hazel, if you look on the corner of Smith Hazel, at Kershaw and Hampton, that part, that low-lying part, floods.
Right.
Why does it flood right there? Because the debris is stopped up the drain. Mm-hmm. It can't cross over Hampton to go down. There's only one drain. And that's on Bamberg, the one that he's talking about, the bottleneck. That's carrying all that water. And once that water fills that drain, it just runs off the old, where the city has the trucks and everything. All that water comes down the hill, runs down Bamberg, then fills up those drains on Saluda and Sumter.
That is the first thing to do, is to try and get everything that is already existing working as it was designed through the
Now,
means.
I think... You know, and are we being short-sighted twice now? We did it in the 70s, and we did it in the early 2000s.
That's correct.
And we're still talking about the same water. And it appears that, and I talked with Mr. Morris on this, and I've talked with James and other neighbors, and I have been in the neighborhood, as James knows. Might even go tonight to just see where the water. But everything he says is right on, and I think there's older city people would know that. But the issue starts at the, I don't know the name of those apartments. It's not on Buford there, but whatever Buford turns.
It used to be Basin Run or Hampton Apartments. I don't know what it's called now.
But anyway, the problem there is that the original pipe was not put in low enough, and then when the city moved the problem down to Jake Place, they just moved it to another place. There was there's a development plan that was done by the Clyburn family for that 20, it's about 32 acres there. They showed the depth it would have to be and they put some ponds in there to take care of all that water. We can do the studies you want to, but eventually to get the water out of there, you're going to have to lower the pipe, and that's not cheap.
Let me just say to you, we're dodging the bullet here. The fact of the matter is that area has long needed infrastructure improvements, major infrastructure improvement. We dodged the bullet, and we need to get it done. We don't have the money to get it done, but there needs to be a plan to get it done.
All I'm saying is you need to look from those apartments all the way back, and when the fellow, and if you'll ask, the planning has a copy of the drawings I got from them that Mr. Clyburn had done in 2006, and his plan took care of all the water from the 30, I believe it was 30 acres, and then the other water coming from up the hill would go around that. So you need to look at all of that, but... I'm just saying, if you do a little fix here, you're going to have a pond of water that has to evaporate out. So, I'm just one voice in the wilderness here, but I think you got a problem that you got to start at the apartments and go all the way back to the sheriff's office.
We were told when they were originally fixing this that the state would not allow that water to cross Buford Street.
But it does.
Slowly.
That's the choke point is there, but we're not getting the water there, and the apartments don't flood. That road going in there, but we're not getting the water to that drain. And that's I've been down there when we've had major rains.
That becomes then your discussion point. If we're defining, Buford Street as our design area, and including Jake's Place, that's a major hydrology study,
right?
And probably a major infrastructure, redesign. Just,
right.
Well, as it is, and we started looking at the properties we owned to try and understand what we could do to build on those properties. And the way we're framing our request for proposal is identify the watersheds that are contributing to that area now, evaluate the localized infrastructure to assess its capability, and then make recommendations for infrastructure using the properties that the city owns in whatever form or fashion they need to do in order not to negatively impact the existing infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And that was the project that we were talking about for the development of homes at Edgewood. And that way we felt like we would do no harm to existing neighborhood. Now, we bring into the discussion, the neighborhood's already harmed. Well, then, that changes the scope. We have to expand it. If that's something we need to look into, then, we can. You don't want to throw good money after bad, I guess, is kind of what would be the thought there. And that would just change the definition of the hydrology study, and then it would get into a larger number just to do the study.
It sounds like that's what we need to do. Because if you just do a little island in there and don't look at what's out there,
sure,
you're only fixing something. But the rest of the neighborhood is
We could certainly get some proposals to find out what that's going to cost.
Exactly. That's
what we'll do. But I think George is right on the numbers. If you're going to get up there, but someday you're going to have to do it. You won't be able to develop it.
Exactly.
And the water does run across Hampton. I've driven through it after a big rain. And so I think we just need to be sure we have it all up on the table and discuss, we've discussed what we're going to do and then go from there.
Well, this is one area, but there are other areas too, and we keep kicking the can down the road.
Right.
And we have got to build in some funds for all this infrastructure needs that's coming up in terms of we've got to. It's going to come back to bite us three times.
Yeah, and that's going to be a good discussion for the capital sales tax project 4.
Right.
As far as the infrastructure.
James, that's 10 years away, so your grandkids will be living there.
No, it's not, because this is 10 years ago before when you did this, back in 6.
If you call it capital project 4, that's 2022 before you see that money. I want you to be sure when you leave here, whether you like the answers or not, you got answers.
But see, I like your answer because I'm willing to work with you. But the neighborhood, the residents, is not going to like your answer.
No, and I understand that.
You know, and that's the terrible part.
Well, the other thing that we could propose, I don't want this repeated, there are other options. It's there's the 1 cent sales tax. We had the water rate increase. There's the option of a tax increase. So there are all these other options, and which one do you favor most?
I rest my case.
Yeah. Want a tax increase?
You know, you're talking more than $1.98.
It's just not just Edgewood, though. You know, we need to fix the problem.
Right.
You know, it's throughout the city. But you know, what I want you to do is make sure when you come into Edgewood that you do it right.
10-15.
Right, and not Band-Aid.
And then, you know, you don't have to build a whole bunch of houses. Just build one or two to get the people interested and get the word low income out of that section. People will be willing to come over there.
Okay. Thank you, James.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much. What time do you want me here next week?
28.
28?
28, 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Y'all have a good night.
Thank you,
sir. Thank you, James.
Which takes us to the next request. Councilmember Everett had asked for an update on the capital sales tax project's 3 projected revenues. That comes on the heels of the email that's in your agenda packet at page 241, along with the projected revenues that Jason Goins, the Aiken County Treasurer, had shared. And we've provided you with updated information on the yellow sheets as of February 22nd. But then we also gave you the projected revenue based on our experience for the capital project sales tax 3. That's on page 246 of your agenda packet, and you'll see
up on the screen
that the original is that page 246?
Yes.
Something just doesn't look right.
It is right. The blue just doesn't show up with the green.
It doesn't show up well at all. It's actually better in your agenda packet. But you'll see, now we only have 2 payments in hand. But taking that, our finance director, Kim Abney, has projected out. And you'll see that, back when we talked about the referendum in 2009-2010, the projected income was $44,600,000. The current projections, if they are conservative, are for $30,900,000. That's in the lower right-hand corner on the sheet that's up on the screen. And again, that affects the ability to work through the projects on the list. In talking with Jason, talking with the folks up in Columbia, the major impact on the reduction in the amount of money that's coming in that we've seen is the exemption that the legislature put on food that can be prepared in the home. That's resulted in this major hit. And see, it can be as much as $10 to $13 million less than what we projected to receive. So this is the projected revenue, and I know that George is preparing, if we take that $30,900,000 figure, George, at your Thursday night budget discussion, we'll have a projected spend out of that money for projects when we meet on Thursday.
All right, when George does that, does it come back to council for review and approval?
For the spend out? Yeah, I mean, we can certainly do that.
Well, I would think George can give us a recommendation from canceling projects or carrying them over, whatever we want.
But it's a proposed spend out, and it's by category. And really, we've had this discussion several times. The expenditures are approved. What we were doing was coming to council. Our understanding was on the staff level that we would bring the individual projects to council for approval that would be part of that spend out.
But we start at the top of the page and work to the bottom.
That's what the spend out does.
And so is that what George will start at the top of the page and work down?
Yeah, and again, we'll have that Thursday, so that might be a good discussion topic at our Thursday workshop.
It will be. Do you spend any money below, you know, if you added up all the projects from the top of the list to a certain point, which would equate to that $30 million, have we spent any money on any of the projects below that $30 million?
Below the $30 million,
question with the what's the priority?
Right. Below the $30 million, we have spent about $200,000 on concepts for the University Parkway. But again, there is going to be money for that. It's just a question of what the actual receipts are going to be, and we'll know that as we get further in. We've had two checks so far. So we'll get a couple more checks this year, and we can adjust that as we see what the checks are when they actually come.
And I think that's a very important point. I mean, I'd hate to see us overreacting based on just getting two checks. I mean, it appears as though the estimate, I haven't heard from the county finance person, and my understanding is that, and he or she is no longer employed at the county, but my understanding is the county finance director is the one that estimated how much money we would receive, and then it was allocated from the county down to us. Of course, $6 million of ours was extra beyond the beyond the 38 that we were going to get. So I don't think we need to, I guess my point is, I don't think we need to be in a rush to do anything, because there's nothing we can do anyway except wait and see what it looks like. I can't imagine anything positive happening, but. And we have made enough money to pay our borrowing from that CPS T3 as well.
We'll finish that out the end of this year.
Yeah, so we're not going to have any money to do anything with for the rest of the year, probably.
Well, this came about, Mr. Pierce mentioned the February meeting, what our payment was. And so I got to adding up, and I said, wait a minute, it must be a partial payment. So I called up the county treasurer, who gives us the checks. And that's all he does, is he brings a check over to the city. Believe it or not, he gets a check from the state for $8 or $10 million, and they mail him a check that he has to deposit. Don't tell me why. Out of the 14 months, and there's been 14 payments out of the 84, and those payments, if you use the 14-month average versus the 2 months, you get about $30,600,000. If you look at these, capital project 2 was $28 million and a couple hundred thousand, and we collected 30. We had a 7% increase in 7 years. Okay, and that was supposedly good in bad times. To make the $44 million, we have to have an 8% increase in revenue every year. That isn't going to happen. So it's somewhere between 1% and 2%. And the state uses 3% growth, but I don't think we need to count it. The whole purpose of this is so when we take a look at the list of Project 3, we start at the top and work down. You sure don't want to plan on the last $10 million of projects. You know, we're not going to have money. And like Mr. Pierce said, you got to look at, you know, Capital 4, assuming it goes. So that's why I brought this up, so we don't get our... Big eyes. Don't need a vote or anything, but it gets important when we get into the budget this time. The pink sheets do have some projects that are probably going to drop off the list, even in the five-year plan. They might be in the eight-year plan, but not the five-year plan.
The question is, you know, we all understand what the $30 million means down the list. Are there other projects within the top end that where the $30 million runs out where we might ignore some of those projects and move it further down?
We'll see what Mr. Pierce and Mr. Grinton come up with, and then it's a council decision to carry them forward, or basically they get canceled to the next Capital 4, because you can't guarantee you're going to get a Capital 4.
Yeah, and that's, again, the advice the city attorney had given you, that council reserved the right to determine the order of the projects.
Really?
So the answer to your question is yes, from the city attorney.
So it's for information, so when we get into the budget, somebody says, oh, gee, I would like the $1.5 million to buy Greenway space. Hey, that's at the bottom of the list, and that money's not there.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I had for it.
Mm-hmm. That's all I have.
It's FYI.
I just have two or three quick. I noticed in the issues and memos that Channel 4 upgrade is completed.
It's in the process
of being completed.
We had to wait on Atlantic Broadband. They're digitalizing their signal.
Yeah, and I don't know how many people watch Channel 4, but it's likely we're going to lose a lot of people because unless they go down to Atlantic Broadband and pick up that free device that Atlantic Broadband is giving, they're not going to be able to watch Channel 4.
There'd be a box.
The other thing is just something to consider long term. AT&T U-verse is supposedly coming into town.
They are. We've got a letter. They are. No.
And that certainly is going to be an alternative to putting our internet bid out, our internet contract out for bid. Right now, it's with Atlantic Broadband, and if there's competition, I'm all for that. We may save ourselves some money. I think
that 3 years is getting close to up that we approved also. We approved Atlantic Broadband use with the city for 3 years. I had a 3-year contract. When they changed from free to that, it was, I don't know if it's $30,000 a year for 3 years or $10,000 for 3 years.
I mean, I could give the number if council would like to have that. They actually wound up not imposing the increases they were entitled to. They kept the rate the same.
And then,
because of the competition.
Yeah, because of that
announcement that was made.
Well,
they came to us and says, we know we have the automatic increase. Well, we're going to waive that. They've not built it.
Yeah. The other thing is that I would appreciate a copy of the RFQ. And again, in your issues and answers, which you do a great job of. I really appreciate what you put in there. You mentioned that the bid for audit services has gone out, and I'd appreciate a copy of that package that went out.
Sure.
Email is fine.
Okay.
And finally, again, I think we understand the importance of, to the best of our ability, of having a centralized list of homeowners associations within the city. I don't think we have that yet. We've come close, but I don't think we have a list of all of them. I don't know.
A list of the ones we know about.
I know, and maybe you could put that in our packet, and those of us that we all represent different parts of the city, and maybe we could add to that list, because I think, I was trying to find one of the homeowners association people. I have no idea how to get a hold of them. So maybe if we could just put what we have in the next packet, and we can make pen and ink changes to it.
I would have to wait on the packet. We just email that out.
Well, whatever. Yeah, whatever. Yeah.
Brings up another issue. Are you finished?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
I was driving along on Silverbluff today, and I saw an accident approximately where Pine Log turns off at the Center South Shopping Center. Mm-hmm. And there were two public safety vehicles there. Mm-hmm. And I was doing all my errands, and on my way back, about 15-20 minutes later, the our public safety vehicles were gone, and there was a state trooper there. Do we always hand off that accident business on a Silverbluff to the troopers, or?
And again, we could look at the specific.
Basically, there was a police presence there for probably close to 45 minutes, and That might slow down traffic, and Silverbluff's pretty bad anyway.
Well, Silverbluff's a state road. I've seen cases where our people wait until the state shows up. Yeah, I don't know if that was the case then, but.
And we can get you the detail on that, Mr. Homoki. I know that if a city vehicle's involved by state law, we have to have the Highway Patrol investigate that. So, again, the circumstances of that wreck, otherwise we would work the wreck in the city limits.
Is it a city vehicle?
As I said, I'll get the detail for you. We could send that out. I don't know. I wasn't there.
Somebody cheekboned somebody.
If a city vehicle's involved or a county vehicle's involved or state vehicle's involved, then the State Highway Patrol would investigate that.
It was two people less than 30 years ago.
Okay. You finished? Here, Jerry.
You'll miss all the fun.
Your favorite.
Yep.